Hey, Project Big Screen listeners, you can find us every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Stella Blue Coffee is more than just great coffee. It's coffee with a purpose. Introducing We Brew to Rescue, a nationwide campaign using proceeds from our new ready-to-drink cans to help fund 1,000 pet adoptions this year. Every can you crack open helps a real pet find a real home. Simple as that. Made with 100% Colombian coffee, each 11-ounce can delivers smooth, drinkable energy with a boost of protein. Available in espresso cafe mocha and espresso sweet cream. Built for mornings, long days, and everything in between. Drink Stella Blue, fuel your day, and help save a pet's life. You can follow our progress in real time throughout the campaign by watching the adoption tracker on our site. Grab yours now at StellaBlueCoffee.com, Amazon, and select retailers nationwide.
Trust no one and accuse everyone. And Who's the Bad Guy? The official Barstool Sports social deduction game from the brilliant mind of Nick Tirrani. In what's quickly becoming the most popular new party game around, players are secretly assigned unique roles, with the good guys trying to expose the bad guys and the bad guys doing everything they can to stay hidden. Each game unfolds under alternating day and night phases, with roles like the cool chick, the shy guy, the gambler, El Presidente, the mentalist, the planner, the funny guy, and more. Every round is unpredictable, chaotic, and ridiculously fun. Who's the Bad Guy is great for parties, pre-games, family gatherings, or groups who just love deception-based games. Game night will never be the same. Shop now on Walmart.com.
All right, on this episode of Project Big Screen, we have two reviews. How to Make a Killing with Glenn Powell. And we also have Nirvana, the band, the show, The Movie. What a mouthful that is. And then we also will have, in honor of Glenn Powell, who's next? Who's the next big Hollywood superstar? We'll do our top 10 picks for candidates for the next big Hollywood superstar. And we'll talk about reviews, excuse me, trailers, not reviews, of Toy Story 5, The Mandalorian and Grogu, and other trailers as well. All that and more coming up on Project Big Screen. All right, episode 21 of Project Big Screen. Last one of the month of February already. The next time that you hear our voices, it'll be the month of the Oscars. Oscars are just so late nowadays, but that's beside the point. It's an Olympic year, so that's why. But a couple more episodes until then, and today we have two movies that are very different, but I'm excited to talk about. How to Make a Killing, Glenn Powell, Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie, the review. No Chris Klemmer today. I wish Chris Klemmer was here. He wrote, I don't want to shit on Klemmer too much, but wrote one of the lamest jokes into his review on Letterboxd. Go check it out on his Letterboxd.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
It's just really, it's a lame joke. But no Chris Klemmer today. He'll be back next week. We'll throw in there what he thought about these two movies, because I think he did put reviews for both them on Letterboxd. And we're also going to talk about, in honor of Glenn Powell, the next big stars of Hollywood. We also have a lot of trailers to get to, too. Some big-time trailers. One for a movie which will probably compete for highest grossing of the year. So we'll get to all that and more after we talk How to Make a Killing, first up. Tragedy Strike. Oh, this is the wrong one. I almost read the synopsis for Wuthering Heights. Disowned at birth by his obscenely wealthy family, blue-collar Beckett Redfellow will stop at nothing to reclaim his inheritance, no matter how many relatives stand in his way. Glenn Powell in the lead role, Margaret Qualley, Jessica Henwick, Ed Harris, Topher Grace, Zach Woods, Bill Camp, not doing well at the box office. A humongous dud. $3.3 million domestic opening. Really a bummer, I think, for a movie like this, that no matter which way you cut it, if you like it or not, like, these are the types of things you wish would do better. Loosely based on a 1949 British dark comedy, Kind Hearts and Coronets, starring the late, great Obi-Wan Kenobi himself, Alec Guinness. Hour and 45 minutes long, directed by John Patton Ford, who also did Emily the Criminal a couple years ago. Really good under the radar movie.
So good.
Seen it. Go check out Emily the Criminal. I think we interviewed Aubrey Plaza for that movie, right, Kendra?
We did.
Yeah. Really good movie. Go check it out. 76% split Rotten Tomatoes. IMDb 6.8. Metacritic 51. Letterboxd 3.3. Kendra, what did you give How to Make a Killing?
By the way, I was looking up the history of the production before this, and I realized that this was a blacklisted script for a while, and originally it was going to be the two big characters, and it was going to be Shia LaBeouf and Mel Gibson.
Oh my god.
Were the original two guys were cast for this movie in like 2013 or something like that, and then it went to hell, and then now revived again. So yeah, I think we ended up with a better movie than that probably would have been. I ended up with a 72 out of 100 for this movie. I think this is a smooth, sexy, sometimes funny thriller that I liked. I think Glenn Powell, after watching this, like, he already one of the most handsome men in the world. He is the most handsome man alive in this movie. And I think he shoulders a really heavy burden as the lead and the narrator, which I think he pretty much nails. I don't think a lot of the supporting cast gets enough time to make a huge impact, but they were all good. And I really liked the way this movie was shot. I think I looked up the cinematographer's name is Todd Bonhazel. He did Winning Time. And I think you could see a lot of that sort of work, the way he shot that in Winning Time and also in this, that sort of like old school rich guy home video Succession intro type shit, which I really liked. I think my issues just kind of come with the runtime. I think this should have either been a little bit shorter, specifically the ending, or longer. I actually texted Gooch after this and I was like, this would have been an excellent miniseries if you had an episode spent with every one of the heirs that they talk about, because like you get guys that can make a huge impact like Zach Woods and Topher Grace, but you just don't have enough time with them really to kind of benefit from what they bring to the table. And I also just think it could have been a little bit better if it just like committed to more of the dark comedy aspect or just to the drama aspect, one or the other. I think that it also, like, to close it, this movie emphasized something for me, which is that with Glenn Powell, he's just too handsome right now to play anybody that's struggling. And I don't know if you guys agree with that. I feel like a lot of movies recently, they cast him, whether it's, you know, Running Man, it's Hitman, it's Anyone But You, Set It Up. It's very hard for me to ever buy him as somebody who is struggling in life, in anything, in money, in love, in career. It's very hard for me to kind of cross that barrier because he's too handsome. People that handsome and charismatic are not struggling in any facet of their life. I think he should be on like the Matthew McConaughey track where he's too handsome for his own good. And like that is his bigger struggle in the movie. And then as he ages, you age him into the ones where you get him more depth out of it. But I liked it. There's definitely some structural issues. So enjoyed it. 72 out of 100 for me.
Gooch, what did you give it?
Had a lot of the same problems. Like it's very weird. My feeling leaving the theater, because it's like I liked it. I really did. And I think a lot of that just has to do with the ensemble. And I never felt myself bored or wishing a scene would end or confused by the decisions being made, really. But it really is just less than the sum of its parts. There's just a foundational issue in the way that it's paced and the way that it moves, where everything at the end just falls flat. And maybe this is because we've had this type of movie quite a bit lately. Like, I see a lot of people calling it Eat the Rich, and I don't know if I'd go that direction with it. It definitely runs in a very similar lane, but it's very class commentary, and it's remarkably similar to a Korean movie that came out like a month ago that came from one of our greatest filmmakers. So that's tough when it's being compared to, I mean, just a lot of better movies. And maybe that's where my issues lie, is just comparison is the thief of joy, and I'm thinking about these other movies and then wishing it was that good, and it's just not. So I'm landing at a 60 out of 100. I could come back to this and end up liking it more. I doubt I go lower than that because, like I said, I really think the ensemble showed up and carried this movie front to finish. Glenn Powell is just a star. He very clearly is, and this was nice to get him back in a role where he gets to be more charismatic. The Running Man felt like something he was trying to do where he was trying to, I think, get out of his like comfort zone a little bit and be an angry guy, a very intense person. And it lacked those moments of brevity that this film allowed him to really flex, and he gets to smile big and, you know, work a room. So that was nice. Margaret Qualley showing off her legs the whole time. Good Lord. John Patton Ford knew how to shoot those legs. He really did. And then Zach Woods, I had no clue outside of Qualley and Powell who else is going to be in this movie. So Zach Woods showing up, Topher Grace showing up, love them. But it just did not end up being one of the great crime comedy, class commentary movies that I really thought it might be. So 60 out of 100.
Yeah, which I do feel like we all kind of grade on like mildly different scales. So mine's only going to be like a hair lower technically number wise than Gooch, but I think I liked it a pretty good amount less than you. I gave it a 59. I didn't really care for this movie. It did not work for me. I thought it was weirdly mismanaged in terms of like pacing and storytelling and runtime. Like I think I agree with Kendra completely, like not enough breathing room on so much of this. We'll get into spoilers in a minute because there's one part in particular I was like, that's what we got just now. This is not much of a spoiler, but obviously, like, there's, you know, like, if you're aware of what this movie is, you kind of get the concept a little bit, right? Like, there's the intent of him killing people, blah, blah, blah. The explanation of some of the kills felt like repetitive and like kind of weak. And I was like, that doesn't, like, okay. I don't mind suspending disbelief. I do it all the time. Like, I know we talked about it for other movies on here too. Like, I can suspend disbelief to levels that are probably like inexcusable at times when it comes to liking movies. But this one, I was like, man, I'm like, you really got to kind of cut some corners on some things. And it just kind of took me out of it a little bit, which I don't ever love being critiqued, but that's just how I felt on this one. And I don't know if he was the right person for this role. He's very charismatic. Now, there's a similar movie in the sense of like killing, but like it's a really not similar Hitman that he was in, which I just think he's just, that's a better type of role for Glenn Powell. More charismatic, and he doesn't do a bad job with this. I just don't think it fits. And also, like, I will say too, this, do you guys agree with this? The way he was in the jail cell, and I guess they do explain it. They explain a little bit his demeanor at the end, but the way he is in the first 5 minutes, like he's this very Patrick Bateman-y kind of character. Yeah. That's not really what he is the rest of the movie either. Like, that isn't really, again, they kind of explain that a little bit. Like, and this is not a spoiler, but he's like, he mentions a calm demeanor when they cut back to it later on, which I guess that explains it mildly. But even then, it was kind of a psychotic, like Patrick Bateman vibe in the beginning. It just wasn't who he was the rest of the movie. I was like, oh, okay. It's also my biggest complaint about this movie, I think, is that it's very clear it's supposed to be a dark comedy. I just didn't find it very funny for most of it. Yeah. The funniest part was Zach Woods, hands down. Like,
so good.
So fucking funny.
Actually, I read a review before I saw it that said he wasn't in it. I actually thought all we were going to get was the fake video at the beginning. He was in it for a little while, and I think the entire time he was in it, there's a dinner scene with him. It is so funny. He is just such an asshole.
So good.
Also, I saw the movie with someone who's never seen Silicon Valley, and they've only really seen him in The Office. Oh. Which, if you've only seen him in The Office, like, I mean, I hated him because Gabe is so annoying. Though over the years, Gabe grows on you because you're like, you're supposed to hate him. But once you see Silicon Valley, you just think of Zach Woods so differently. So I think that did help. I didn't hate my time, right? Like, you kind of said Gooch. Like, there was no point where I'm like, ugh, like, I kind of want to get out of here. Like, I never thought that, but I was kind of waiting for more and like never really totally got. And there's one thing particularly we'll talk about in spoilers in a second that really irked me. But yeah, this was a bit of a letdown. I think you said it best, Gooch. There's a very similar movie that just came out that's just better too. Just way better.
When you really just think about it, it is so similar to No Other Choice. Like, he's just lining up people to kill him and take out his competition to climb the class ladder. Like, that is the movie. And it's better shot, better paced, funnier, like, more well acted. Like, it's tough. It's very tough. How do you guys feel about, like, this is so weird that this is the follow-up for, like, the problems that exist in this movie for John Patton Ford? Because I think Emily the Criminal, its strength was its pacing. The way Correct. It was constructed, it moved so well. And for that to be an issue here, that's the last thing I would have guessed, to be honest.
Maybe part of it is just, like, Emily the Criminal was pretty straightforward. And, like, this one, like, you got time jumps. You got a lot of different characters you got to talk to. You got, like, all these different places you got to go. You got a lot of this other, like, whatever, settings, locations, and all that shit. A lot longer of a period to pace it out over it. Maybe that was it. But I would agree with you. Like, Emily the Criminal, I think maybe it's because it was just so stripped down. And it's so simple and straightforward. And, like, as far as, again, structure goes. But I really like that. And, man, just thinking about the Zach Woods. Do you remember the scene in Silicon Valley where he's talking, like, they're trying to act cool? And he's like, hey, Dinesh, nice chain. Do you get it when you what do you say? Do you choke your mother with it when you put your penis in her butthole? And, like,
yeah,
God, dude, he's so funny. Yeah,
his delivery the entire show is, because that character is really not that much dissimilar to Gabe in The Office. Yeah. No. But it's just, I don't know why, it fits so perfectly, because he's kind of on the level playing field with, like, the Silicon Valley bros,
yeah,
the tech nerds. So he's great.
Would you guys agree with the miniseries thing, though? Because I feel like this is really, like, there's parts of this, like, there is obviously, I think, a great movie here somewhere, because all the parts.
I mean, we should spoil it, because I think it is tough to talk about just some of, like, what happens. I would agree with you. If this was, like, more drawn out and, like, I appreciate that some of the kills were glossed over quickly, like, that adds to the humor a little bit, but then, like, you do it a couple times, so it's like, okay, like, that kind of felt stale. And the big thing for me was the showdown with the grandfather at the end just felt so weird. Quick yep. And so
just a waste of Ed Harris.
Big waste.
Not satisfying. And even like, I guess I don't need the explanation of like, I guess I get why he threw his daughter out of the house, but like, if you revisit it and you don't give me much more, it just feels kind of weak. I don't know. It just didn't land. Like, it didn't hit. It was a cool scene, but like the emotion of it, the payoff, like, because that's the moment to make this guy who you probably shouldn't be rooting for. That's where it should really make you want to root for him. And it kind of never delivers there.
Yeah. I think if you get like, that was a full finale episode of a series and you get like a full episode of Zach, like even Topher Grace, Topher Grace, I think, was really good. You just get 5 minutes of him. So, like, if you get a full episode with him, you get a full episode of this guy, and you see the development of, like, Glenn Powell as the character going from, like, you know, being this guy, I'm from the streets, I'm going to work my way up, I'm going to scrap, I'm going to claw, to, like, kind of turning into, like, oh, I'm a psychopath. Like, that could have been, I think, interesting, just given more time. There's just not enough time. There's not enough time for a story like this, you know? And I think it's different with something like No Other Choice, because like it's not family, it's, you know, and it's, these aren't like real character-y characters. A lot of them is just it's just different. It's a workplace. So I don't know. I think it would have been better suited for that. What did you guys think? This is my other big thought leaving it. I wish the ending was, it ended 5 minutes earlier, because I did not like the second added on bit to the ending. It should have just ended, I feel, with him in the jail looking at the clock being like, she's coming, right? And like, bam, cut the black, you're done. But like when they added on all that stuff, I'm like, what are we doing here? It's not over yet. Like,
I wouldn't have minded if it would have ended when the guy said, you're not going to fucking believe this. When the guard says that to him, he's going to let him out. Like, I'd have been okay with that too. I do agree with you.
Well, you had to get he had his little like Shiv moment in the back of the car. Yeah. Like, that was basically the Shiv getting in the car with Tom at the end of Succession. And he just like.
Shout out to great YouTuber Cosmonaut Marcus. He always talks about needle drops, like overuse of needle drops. I thought there was too many songs in this movie. Like, I think like an overload. Some great choices, some really worked. I thought that last song did work with that scene, even though Jack didn't love it. But like, I thought there was a few too many song moments that I didn't love.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I'm trying to think.
What's up next for Glenn Powell? This has been a little bit of a skid for him.
It's not even,
and I'm not worried.
I wouldn't say in any of those movies, like, he's kind of a do-it-all guy, but you need to have him in the right spot. Like, I don't think it's ever a movie like with Running Man or this or other things where I'm like, this movie is bad because Glenn Powell is wrong. Like, I've never like, he's the reason this is failing because he can't act or he fails here. It's usually like, maybe this movie isn't built correctly around him. And I think if he was better fit, it would be great. Like, I'm never like, he's doing a bad job.
Yeah, I don't. And like and we're going to do our list later of like 10 people who could be like superstars in Hollywood. And that's obviously a very tough thing to define. Like, if we're going to put it up to the level of Tom Cruise, I'm not sure anybody can be anymore. Like, I just don't think that exists anymore. But in terms of like big stars, like, he's well known. He's a star, but he hasn't reached that level yet where like you're racing out to where even like you're getting the hype, right? Like, I got to say, it hasn't shown in the box office for her, but even like Sydney Sweeney's movies at least get talked about more than Glenn Powell's movies, right? Like, and obviously they were in together in a romantic comedy that did very well in theaters. And like, her box office performances have been some duds, though I do think, even though she was the worst part of The Housemaid, she is what made people probably go see The Housemaid. Like, she was kind of like the name. But him, it's like, you don't hear about. By the way, I live in like a weird zone where like I live, the theater I go to is like 10 minutes where he went from high school. And I literally think that people show up to support him like it's like a football game. I think he played lacrosse at Westwood here in Austin. But like, it's always packed for Glenn Powell movies here. So if you only lived here, you would think his movies make $10 billion. but everywhere else, like, you don't. Like, if I would have said a couple weeks, and granted, The Housemaid's based off a big book, I get that. But even then, like, even that the boxing movie, I feel like, kind of made its way around the internet, right? Like, you even saw like the screenshots.
Oh, big time.
And I don't know, it's an interesting discussion with him, because I think the best thing he's in right now is Chad Powers. It's not even a movie.
Yeah. So like, I think you would work more with the comparison with something like Running Man, where it's a remake of an IP and it's based off a book from a storied author. I think with this, I don't think the expectations should have been box office smash
for sure.
Like, definitely not as bad as it is, but it definitely shouldn't have been like, holy shit, how is this not making like $100 million easily? Like, it should have been. I think the expectations are certainly a little bit lower. And for Housemaid, yeah, I would agree. There is definitely a big section of people that were not going to go see this because they didn't hear the book, and then they hear Sydney Sweeney's going to make a big movie where she's butt naked. I'm going to go watch it. So there is definitely an element of that which you don't get out of Glenn Powell.
It's also like Sweeney for The Housemaid. The reason it worked is because that's her audience. Like, that is exactly her audience that she is pitching to. The boxing movie doesn't work because the audience for that is not her audience. Americana, you know, smaller movie, but didn't really get talked about because very much not her audience. Powell's audience is middle America. That's just what it is. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just he is a middle America face and actor. His choices lately, I think, have veered away from that. Twisters was a good hit for him. That was for middle America.
Yeah.
Yep. Chad Powers has been good for him. That's for middle America.
So Twisters is tough. So how much of Twisters do you credit the fact that it's fucking Twisters?
It's Twisters, right? Plus,
like, if it was like existing IP. If it was a movie called like Tornado Alley and it had nothing to do with the original movie, like, I do wonder.
Man, he was so cool in that though.
I like him a lot. Like,
oh, I love him.
If I'm making a movie and I'm making a big thing, like, I'm like, he's gonna be someone who's just like, I like him quite a bit. But it is like and again, this wasn't gonna be a box office smash. He said it right, but it is like there's a level of hype with his stuff that just isn't there. And he also picks different projects, right? Like, maybe he could just lean into only doing big time blockbuster stuff. Maybe that's if that's his goal, but I'm not sure it is either, though. So
he has coming up, when I can see a Ron Howard firefighter movie, which I don't know if that's the direction, or maybe it is. It might actually be the perfect direction for him. I'm not sure.
I was about to say, that actually sounds like that sounds like it's good for him.
The Natural Order, which is a Barry Jenkins movie about no plot yet, but he's only kept one cast so far. He has an untitled Judd Apatow Universal project about a country western star having a dramatic downfall that must navigate their career in freefall. Interesting.
Yeah. That sounds great.
And then The Great Beyond, a newlyweds couple struggles to survive against a supernatural entity from J.J. Abrams. Okay. And then Chad Powers. So, I mean, some interesting stuff there. I would say, I think the country western thing sounds like you could not draft a better fit for him there. And Ron Howard, maybe. Ron Howard firefighter movie might actually be fucking awesome. We haven't had a good firefighter movie in a while either.
He looks good just in uniform is the thing. Yeah. He's one of those guys that you put him in like any kind of serviceman uniform, he's going to look good in it.
It's like Johnny Sins, PG.
He's the Johnny Sins of actors.
Yeah. Like, you have him like with the, you know, like the nursing outfit. Yeah. Like,
oh my God. He loves wearing costumes. So, I mean,
he does. He fucking loves dressing up.
Yeah. He needs too. Like, even nesting doll of it. Yeah.
I can't decide if he needs to like continue with the bit like that, like being just part of his like every single role, I guess he's ever going to do now, or if he just needs to ditch it. Cause it does feel like it's getting a little ham-fisted into these movies at this point. One last compliment on him, because I know we were kind of ragging on him here for 5 minutes, but we all really like him. I'd also say there is an interesting element to him where he's a screenwriter, and I find that very fascinating. Like, he's very clearly interested in becoming a writer, which for a guy who looks like him and has those leading man charms and qualities, it's like, that's an interesting pitch. It's like a guy who can throw 102 and then has a knuckleball in his back pocket.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious how many more, like, does he go back to the well on, like, the blockbuster stuff? Does he go back to the well on the Twister stuff? And, like, I don't know, or does he try to do smaller things? Does he try to do, you know, things that might hit in different ways than a Top Gun or a Twisters? So it is very interesting because I don't know what his end goal is. I assume it's not. I mean, people like to anoint him as like, you know, Tom Cruise light, right? Because he's kind of took him under his wing and all that stuff. And I'm not sure that's the path that makes sense, or that's like what he'll be. Because he is still very popular, still very well known. But it is a very intriguing thing to kind of break down for me, because that's kind of all I thought about when I left the movie yesterday. It's like all I thought about.
He might be a really interesting bad guy, because think of how good he was in Top Gun in that role.
Great.
Like, he was awesome, like charismatic, handsome, like, man, you know, girls want to fuck him, guys want to be him type dude. Like, he could have performances like that, but obviously, like, I feel no Hollywood agent wants that for an actor in this stage of their career to go into the villain realm. But man, he could be really good at it if he wanted to.
They should remake Man from U.N.C.L.E. and let him be like the American agent. I don't know who would be the British one, but he would be great as like the asshole American agent.
Ooh, yeah. Wait, so he would be the Soviet? He'd be the American, you're saying, or the Soviet?
Oh, wait, I forgot. Yeah, I forgot. He's a Wait, who does is Armie Hammer an American in that movie?
Armie Hammer is the Soviet. Henry Cavill is the American.
What the fuck? So he would absolutely be the American. Like, he's just too American.
He's definitely the American. The Soviet, that would be interesting. I wonder who that could be. Oh, Sklenar. There we go. Book it.
Brandon Sklenar. Sklenar, boy.
Make $1 billion with Brandon Sklenar as your Soviet agent.
The boy, as they call him, Brandon Sklenar.
Clemmer's number one. By the way, for our draft we got, or our ranking coming up, he would be Clemmer's number one with a bullet, Brandon Sklenar.
Clemmer would, yeah. He's a Sklenar head. He fucking loves Sklenar. Yeah. Wait, what did you call him? A Sklenard?
He's Sklenarded.
He's Sklenarded. you never go full Sklenard.
That's great. That's great. We gotta keep that one alive. All right. So how to make a killing? Kind of a range of like okay to didn't enjoy or didn't love. Definitely check it out. Because I do think there's a group of people who would love a tight, just it still can be a fun watch if you really, I think, turn your brain off and not get too lost in it. But I think the potential is what crushed me here. I just think it could have been so much better. That's how to make a killing. I would say check it out, but temper those expectations. All right, review time now for Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. So I'm gonna read you the synopsis of the show if you don't know what the show is. This is made by Matt Johnson, who's in the show along with Jay McCarroll. Matt Johnson was, if you're watching and you don't know who I'm talking about, and you saw Blackberry, he directed the Blackberry movie. He was the long haired, kind of more like, you know, nerdy,
gross looking human.
No other way to put it.
So the show, I'm going to read it directly from the source here. Stars creators and lifelong best friends Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll as fictionalized versions of themselves in a band called Nirvana the Band, consisting of Jay improvising on piano and Matt doing improvised spoken word performances. The duo engage in a series of complex publicity stunts around their home city of Toronto in the hopes of landing a gig at the Rivoli, despite the fact they have never actually written or recorded a single song, nor taken any steps to contact the management about booking a show. So it's a Canadian show, Canadian sitcom. Do either of you watch the show or have seen the show? I knew nothing about it. I knew about it. I didn't like.
Not prior to the movie. I have torn through a season and a half over the past week, though. Yeah.
Would you recommend?
Absolutely. If you like the movie,
I'm going to definitely try and watch it. I'm a little hooked on some TV right now, but I'll definitely, we'll get to that later. I'm definitely going to watch it. So the movie, when they're planning to book a show at the Rivoli, goes horribly wrong. Matt and Jay accidentally travel back to the year 2008. Also, the official synopsis says blah, blah, blah at the end. So you can kind of get the sense of what type of movie it is. Hour and 42 minutes long. Again, based off the Canadian sitcom. 1.85 million domestic, smaller movie. Huge splits around tomatoes, 96-95, 8.5 IMDb, 78 Metacritic. Letterboxd 4.5, which is massive. Most of the times we give Letterboxd scores, they're like high threes. There's a couple that have creeped in the four. So that's a huge. Letterboxd has loved this movie. Gooch, what did you give Nirvana the Band, the Show, the Movie?
Yeah, and I'm right there with them, man. I'm at an 85. I fucking love this movie. I told you I really had no awareness. Like, I know Matt Johnson. I recognize these, like, clips from the show just being on the internet. Sometimes those reaction videos pop up, but really had no awareness of, like, what this was going in. Leaving the theater, immediately had to find, like, more of it. Had to find more of it. Watch a season and a half. I'm hooked on the show. I love this. Reminds me so much of the feeling I had sitting in the theater was the feeling I had sitting in the theater when I was 13 watching Hot Rod and being like, these guys are from the internet and they get my sense of humor and it's so specific, so weird, but everyone else in the theater is laughing too. So I guess we all like this. I had such a fucking fun time, and what they're doing in the movie is not just funny, but it's like really cool. Like what they've done with it in terms of, they just had all this backlog footage and the ideas that they had on paper 15 years ago and the way they followed through on it. And I got to say, shout out to their editors and everyone behind the scenes, because I can't imagine what a nightmare putting this together was. That's what I keep thinking the whole time watching, like, audio nightmare. Everything that they're doing is just, like, in terms of production, is harder to pull off than, like, shooting in the volume, doing really major special effects works. Like, it's so seamless and feels just so natural. I loved it. I want to hear what you guys think, because this is, like I said, it just feels like one of those things that just, it just crept out of the internet and somehow wasn't cringe to me. Loved it. 85 out of 100.
Ken Jack, your review on Letterboxd I saw kind of encapsulates mine, so I won't steal your thunder. So you can go ahead next.
Sure. Yeah, I landed on a 70 out of 100. I think this is a really charming movie. I think that's the big word that I came away from with it. And I think it really wants to connect you with that 2000s YouTuber vibe, and it does that really well. And I think it's really hard to do as well, like because that comes off like inauthentic when you watch a sort of YouTuber, when they try to make a YouTuber type of clip in a big movie, it comes off really fake and inorganic. And I feel like it really captures like an authentic spirit of it here. And you can tell these guys have like a really deep passion for the characters, which makes it really easy to connect with them. And as someone who never watched the web series like you guys and only knew Matt Johnson through Blackberry, which I really liked, by the way, I think that's one of the more underrated movies of whatever that was 2 years ago. Awesome. The fucking I'm from Waterloo where the vampires hang out. Like that's just, it's an unreal. It's such a good movie. And I think it's a cool concept. Like Gooch said, editing nightmare, I imagine, going back and forth and cutting across all that YouTube footage. And it definitely doesn't overstay its welcome either, which is nice, because sometimes these passion projects, you really want to get like every single thing that you want on the screen, and sometimes that's hard, and I think it doesn't. I do think my movie-going experience got tainted a little bit by the expectations, because the film Twitter and et cetera kind of set the bar at, like, this is one of the funniest movies of the decade. I think I had like one loud laugh at the movie, and I think my entire theater had two. And I just don't think it was as funny as not the movie advertised, but as like the film community advertised. But I don't think that's the value of the movie. I don't think the value of the movie to me is comedy. I think it's more like it's a really, really nice movie that charms me, not amuses me. You know what I mean? Like, I'm more like, I like these guys. I have a smile on my face throughout this entire movie. And I'm like just sitting there like, yeah, like they get it. They get it. They get it. Like, I'm not like, oh my God, I'm fucking dying laughing. It's just a really nice story that it's really easy to root for. And I think there's a lot of cool messages within it about, like, you know, friendship and artistry, struggling artistry, like all that stuff. And I think it's loyal to its own stuff, because there's definitely moments and that I think are like, I view it where I'm like, I don't totally get this because I don't know Canadian stuff or I don't know the web series, but it's not distracting from my movie going experience at all. And I appreciate that they'd made this in conjunction both for their fans of the web series and for new people. And as a new person that liked it, I'm with Gooch. I'm like, I want to go and watch this now. Like, I want to learn more about this. But definitely, I would say the value of this movie comes way more from like the charm and sort of like weird charisma of them versus being like, this is so funny. I think there's just kind of like a disconnect there for me. But I liked it other than that, for sure.
Yeah, I liked it maybe a hair more. Score was, I gave it an 81. I really did enjoy it. Like, it makes me really want to watch the show. And then maybe go back and probably like it even more. Their chemistry together is kind of, Hot Rod's the perfect comp for this. It works so well. They're so enjoyable together. There's some just, I don't want to spoil some. There's a couple great moments, one with a song in particular that made me laugh very fucking hard. A couple moments of shock that kind of get you to that had my theater laughing pretty hysterically. Solid, well done in terms of time travel as well, because that's where this could have been like brutal, right?
Yeah, we've learned the lessons
because you can do one of two things with a movie like this, right? That comes off of a show that has a niche might be the wrong word for this, but we'll say for the sake of the conversation, a niche fan base. You can either go full scale, balls to the wall, ridiculous, where you don't care what the quality is, you're doing it for the fans. It's funny and stupid, and it can be broken down into clips and stuff. I'm referencing one movie in particular, Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie. I'm a huge Tim and Eric fan. That movie doesn't work really well as a movie, but it grows in you over time, and it's just like mini Tim and Eric clips strung together in a movie, and it ends up being funny, and I reference it all the time. Or you could make a real attempt, like a real, real, real attempt, and it's either going to be probably like excellent like this or really corny and stupid. And I will say, when I was like time travel thing, I was like, oh fuck, this is gonna be fucking bad.
LCB time travel episode.
Yeah, and it ended up being great. Like, they ended up working it, they worked it in perfectly, like fully understood how to weave it in to the story without making it corny and stupid. So I give them credit for that. They know what they're doing. Shout out Matt Johnson. I hope he, I mean, I don't know what else he's planning on making or planning on doing.
doing the Bourdain biopic with Dominic Sessa.
That's right. That's great. Yeah. See, he's now, I mean, he's two for two, like a smash hit two for two on things that like the Blackberry movie, like it's like at a time where there's so many product movies, right? That everything was like a product movie, like fucking Flamin' Hot Cheetos, Tetris. Tetris is a good movie though. Tetris is a cool movie. They came out with that Blackberry movie, which was this very bizarre mix of biopic and dramedy that worked so well and had like a bit of absurdity, but told the real story. So he is a like big time, give me everything he's got next. Like, I want to see what he does next.
Made me like Jay Baruchel.
This kind of cemented it for me.
Like, I hate Jay Baruchel, and I watched that movie, and I'm like, damn, do I like Jay Baruchel? Like, that was a huge barrier for me to cross, and Matt Johnson got there.
Jay Baruchel. What's me?
And every one of the great movies of like that Apatow ever, he's just there, and I'm like, ugh. And then I watched that movie, and I'm like, damn, Jay Baruchel can act.
No, he's great.
Yeah, he's great in that. Yeah, I don't think I realized the Bourdain movie. Yeah, Dominic Sessa, Bourdain, Leo Woodall's in it, Antonio Banderas, Emilia Jones, Stavros is in it. Yeah, that's great. More of that guy. Wouldn't that be incredible if he just made like great biopics? Just like just took a genre that has just such. The life sucked out of it, and he just finds a way to make very unique, different ones. Apparently, it says biographical drama, obviously a sad ending to the life of Anthony Bourdain. So maybe that's the kind of the way they do it by A24. But yeah, that'd be cool if that's like his thing. He just makes great fucking biopics. That'd be pretty awesome.
I mean, Bourdain is like, thank God he's got his hands on it, because in the hands of like a studio, just kind of, you know, journeyman, like that movie fucking sucks. That movie will be so fucking bad.
The Ron Howard. The movie should only be Bourdain talking about how much he likes Popeyes.
You
got a hangover. You got to come to this spot, Hell's Kitchen. This is my spot. You got to order it. You got to get spicy chicken.
It's just him and Jollibee for 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Tony, can you please leave? Okay. Dude, the 2008 joke. The reveal is. I know, Ken Jack, you say not one of the funniest comedies of the decade. I disagree, but that is one of the best jokes in a movie. That killed me. That killed the theater. Like, brought the house down. When he's sitting there and just paging Doctor.
Black Eyed Peas got me more than that did. Black Eyed Peas, I think, was.
Yeah, that was the.
Because like the second they say I'm going to the hangover, I'm like, okay, well, that's the joke they're immediately going to go to. But like the Black Eyed Peas playing was what really, that really got me. That got the laugh out of me, plus the gunshot, shooting the guy was like, that was like, oh.
And that was the other one I was talking about. Yeah.
That was like the ultimate, like, oh, that's not going to happen. Oh, it happened. Like,
they could have, I could have hated every single second of the movie up until the Black Eyed Peas thing, and that would have had me hook, line, and sinker. I could have been walking out, and I'd have been like, okay, I would have repaid for the ticket.
Like, that's us. That's us. That's our one of the jokes we love. Yeah.
I'm very excited. I don't do a ton of rewatches within the year of things coming out. If things become clear to be Best Picture nominees, I will rewatch them. I'm gonna watch the show, then I'll rewatch this one pretty much immediately. Just because I do want to watch it with the context of someone who's watched the show as well. Do you think that made you like it more?
It's wildly impressive because every episode has this. It's like this weird inverse of like Seinfeld, where Seinfeld has no plot. This has like the same exact plot every episode. Like every episode is what they did in the movie. They're just trying to get a show at the Rivoli. Every single episode, nothing changes, and then they just rip off like a different, like this one was Back to the Future. They do like My Dinner with Andre, they do Dog Day Afternoon. So it's all like, this is why I think Matt Johnson, like if you watch the show, you will buy all the stock in Matt Johnson, because of how he's parodying every single episode. I think he's had to learn how to make all these different movies and all these different styles. It's very fast. Like, he's learning on the fly, you can tell, on how to figure out how to make My Dinner with Andre and how to make Dog Day Afternoon or Jurassic Park or all these things and make it work within an hour-long show. And it's very fucking funny. They also get away with something which I think is like the hackiest thing in comedy, which is like the flashback in black and white slow-mo. Mm-hmm. The way they use it, though, and the way they modulate the voices and they like reframe. They almost like it's like a
add
different
stuff on,
they
yeah.
change things a little bit. So people are making different faces and stuff like that. It kills me every single time. Yeah, no. Jay McCarroll also pretty fucking funny actor. Like he should be in more. He should be in Matt Johnson's stuff moving forward. Like as an actor, I thought he had some great delivery.
Yeah, he's or I guess maybe more so with him. I guess both of them. What I've liked too is watching afterwards, how earnest and interesting they are. Like as far as like the press tour, I guess is all this coming out. Like I'm sure you saw like that he flew to Toronto because he heard they like booked out a theater or something like that. Like they're very. Very, you know, I don't know if like maybe like humble or like with the fans and like thankful about it. And like they're very just into this universe and world and their fans. And I like that. I like when directors and actors are kind of break that veil. I kind of like how we talked about with like Timmy, like when Chalamet's like, I want to be the best in the world, blah, blah, blah. Like it's like when you break that veil down of like the sort of semi professionalism and realize like art is just, you know, it's fun. It's you know, you can have fun doing this. I really appreciate that as well.
Yeah. This is a definite go see this movie. Like, without question.
Great, great interview clips. That's all I add. Like he went on Stavi's podcast. Very funny on there. Like he's very candid about his movie opinions. Like he'll call like Bo is Afraid a piece of shit yeah. that Joaquin like carried to the finish line. Like he does not hold back. It's, I like listening to him and his opinions.
Definitely check out Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. And Hey, watch the show, man. That I'm definitely going to do that. Now that I've seen this, but yeah, Matt Johnson, I did Blackberry as well. So if you like Blackberry, definitely go check this out. And again, we'll cape for it every time, a comedy in theaters. What more can you ask for, folks? What happens when you lock 18 coworkers in an office for 1 week to compete for $250,000 of cash? This is Surviving Barstool Season 5, presented by Rumble Premium, where each episode releases 3 hours early. So get it ad-free before anybody else, only when you join Rumble Premium. New episodes of Surviving Barstool will be released every Sunday and Wednesday, leading up to the Labor Day finale on September 7th. You can watch Surviving Barstool at 5 p.m. on Rumble Premium and everywhere else at 8 p.m. Eastern. We'll start out with trailers first, because the trailers are there's some big ones here. One I didn't know was a movie that existed until I saw this trailer, and I'm just very curious what Ken Jack thinks about it. But let's start out with Toy Story 5. After Woody left Bonnie to help abandoned toys find owners, Jesse becomes the leader of Bonnie's room with Buzz Lightyear as her second in command. However, a now 8-year-old Bonnie has become enamored of her new favorite plaything, a frog-like tablet named Lilypad, voiced by Greta Lee. Conan O'Brien also in this movie in a new role. It comes out June 19th, 2026. I think while the fourth movie was maybe not as good as the first three, it's like still one of the better animated movies probably ever made. It's like that weird, Toy Story has this weird thing where it's like your first three, especially your first and your third, are considered like all-time movies, period. The greatest trilogy of all time, according to Quentin Tarantino. Said he won't watch the fourth because the third is like the best ending to a trilogy that's ever been made. But the fourth is solid. And I understand the idea of the fifth maybe being unnecessary, but they're kind of 4 for 4. So I have no reason to believe why they wouldn't be 5 for 5, because there's a lot of care put in the Toy Story. So I think it's timely. It's a timely, as someone who now has friends who have kids around the age of Bonnie and Toy Story, screen time is, I mean, fuck, talking like we don't sit on our screens all day too. But obviously it's very relevant in terms of like storytelling of kids with toys and stuff. And it's funny, like watching those age kids watch Toy Story, and it's like, that's not how they play with toys anymore. So it's like, to have this is like, that's the big reason to do it, I think. But I'm looking forward to this. This thing's going to make a just god sum of money too. It makes so much money.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to know what I thought about this? Because Woody's bald. Was that what you were getting out here?
No. He should go to Turkey, though.
That was the big joke coming
by the way. That got me, by the way, that he's just bald. I'm like, that's kind of great. That's a great. And that actually, if you give me the one reason why you believe in Toy Story, I'm like, they just take a different set of care with Toy Story. And not that Pixar's made some like still makes good movies. They've had a couple duds, but like that's like, I'm like, yeah, that's funny. Like, I like that. That's a good call on their part.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like, I agree with what you're saying. Like, I think that was our takeaway with Toy Story 4, right? It's like, this is good, but like the ultimate thing is when you have a perfect trilogy, do you really want to add on to it? And is it like, is this better than 3? No. Is it better than 2? I don't think so, but like I see why some people might think that, whatever. But like it's just like I get if it was much worse, I'd be angrier about it, Toy Story 4. But it's still just a functionally good movie.
This one also feels more necessary. Like this one does feel more like the last one had a great message, and it was like Forky was a sensation, became a big character. People like Forky, they did a good job with that. But like I understood the unnecessary thing. Like I get it with this one. Like you're yeah. tackling a very modern thing with kids, and it's like I get it. Like this is probably more necessary, I'd argue.
It's definitely more of like an update. Like there's more of a reason to make this one than there is the last one, just because there is an actual subject matter to touch on. But that is more pertinent, I guess. But it's just like I do worry about with something like this, how on the nose are you going to be? Because like is it just going to be like mm-hmm. kids play with tablets now, and like that's the joke, and like that's what I worry about a little bit. But I don't know. I mean, they're 4 for 4, I would say. So it's how do you? I think you put a little bit of trust in them. And this is the movie franchise that built this whole studio. So I have some faith in them there.
Yeah, this will definitely be the hardest one to pull off for sure. And they've gotten progressively harder just by the nature of like toys fucking suck now. Like they just get worse and worse and less cinematic. Like it will be a very tough challenge because. If you're just like iPads, tablets suck, that's just a kind of miserable movie. You're like, oh man, the youth are not okay. So I guess they're gonna have to make the technology fun. Like it's gonna have to be enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And my other ask for the movie would be that it is, and I love the Toy Story, like we grew up with it, and the franchise in a way aged with us and touched on things as we aged and kind of really lined up with all three of our like where we were in life when they were coming out. I would like a little bit of a reset and go back to this is for children, strictly almost for children, and reset the franchise in a way.
Which I think this one probably will a little bit. I think that's at least the goal. That's what my read is. And again, I want to stress like the people involved have a lot of care in it. Obviously, John Lasseter are no longer involved in these, but Andrew Stanton, who has written on all of them, all five. Mm-hmm. He's directing Toy Story for the first time, but he directed Finding Nemo. He directed Wall-E. Shout out, directed John Carter. that's okay. He's written on, he's been a writer on just the best of the best of Pixar. So this is like the right person behind it too. It's not like they threw it to someone who like wanted to do Toy Story. They definitely protect this with great care. And I think that's the trust for me. So. I'm looking forward to it. Like, I mean, very excited. They a first one officially too with Mr. Potato, with all the Potato Heads and Ham recast. Obviously, as we've lost some pretty iconic voices over the years. Not Ham. General Ratzenberg still very much alive, but Mr. Potato Head and Mrs. Potato Head, excuse me.
Potato Heads, Don Rickles.
So yeah, that's that was a big note that people had.
Trying to think of like what other toys people play with that could even be in like a Toy Story thing. Like who's that kid that reviews toys? Or maybe he's not even a kid anymore. Do you remember who I'm talking about?
Like he was a YouTuber. He was pulling like 8 figures a month.
Yeah. And like he got his own toy line, like with the eggs and stuff. Like I feel like you could do stuff with that. You could do stuff with like someone like Miss Rachel. Like there's a lot of stuff you could pull from that kids are into.
I'm sure that's what'll be on the screen, right? I'm sure the screen will have like a Miss Rachel type character, is my guess.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what the boys are playing with these days? What? Fucking Beyblades. Beyblades are hot in the streets.
Nice. Beyblades are back?
They've been hot for like 3 years now. Like really, really hot. My mom runs a daycare, and so like I get a little bit of a peek behind the curtain on what the kids are playing with. I was shocked when I found out they're like trading like each other's like toppers and like whatever. So get a Beyblade in there. Let's have some Beyblade battles in Toy Story.
There's another recast. Who is
Let's get Bionicles back too while we're at those rocked.
Obviously, I didn't mean to mention her. Estelle Harris, obviously, recast, passed away, played voice of Miss Potato Head, but also, someone else, because I think Carl Weathers voiced a character.
Did he? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Carl Weathers voiced Combat Carl, and Ernie Hudson's voicing Combat Carl, so that's another recast. Obviously, a newer character.
Yeah.
Wasn't in the main line first three, so
Ernie Hudson being like 80 years old and just jacked out of his mind is every time I see that it just pisses me off. He's humongous and lean at that age. It's nuts.
And most importantly, I don't know. I failed to mention Ken Jack's favorite Wallace Shawn back as Rex, obviously.
Of course, Beast Mode,
one of the all time voices. Wallace Shawn.
He's got one of the greatest of all time, in my opinion.
So Toy Story 5 will be up there. It will be. There's going to be a pretty great race this year for highest grossing movie. I assume it's going to be probably this and Avengers. We'll see how much Avengers hits for people. I think this obviously has like the guaranteed success because no matter what, it's fucking Toy Story. But this is going to make a shitload of money. It's going to make a lot. That is Toy Story 5. Mandalorian Grogu next. First full trailer because there was a teaser. The New Republic enlists Din Djarin, and they hear the Mandalorian and his apprentice Grogu following the fall of the Galactic Empire during a period where remaining Imperial warlords threaten the galaxy. The latest Martin Scorsese movie, Mandalorian and Grogu. He is voicing a character in this movie, which is so bizarre. When I first saw the trailer, I'm like, that sounds like Martin Scorsese. I'm like, there's no way. I'm like, I know him and Jon Favreau are friends. Like, they have a good relationship. So I was like, is this like a weird Jon Favreau giving Martin Scorsese like a nod to Scorsese in Star Wars? But no, it's legitimately him. He's voicing the role. Jon Favreau directing, Sigourney Weaver in a new role. Jeremy Allen White voices one of the Hutts, kind of like a
Rada.
Yeah, like a gladiator hut, basically. I'm excited. I'm not going to pretend this looks unbelievable by any stretch of the imagination, but I'll tell you what, if all this is a 75 out of 100 fun Star Wars action adventure that I see on TV, you will have me pleased as punch. Like that's kind of all I need. And if it's better than that, then whatever. It's just good to see Star Wars on the fucking big screen again. Like it's been long enough. I hope it's just a good ass time. That's really my bar is so low on this. That's really all I'm hoping
Solo.
For. And I love The Mandalorian. The last season was not as great as the first two. The first two were fucking awesome. But yeah, I am looking forward to it. Though I do understand some of the reservation on it a little bit. Like I don't really have much of a counter to that.
Yeah, I've come to accept that this just won't be like, it won't be like The Force Awakens. I don't even think it's like that level or even The Last Jedi for me. Like, it's
and I'm just glad they're a not completely different that, vibe, right?
Yeah, and I was about to say that, like, I like this the new trailer, and we waited so fucking long for it. It really was like kind of like a mask off, like, here's what it's gonna be. Like, it's gonna be what you expect, like the Filoni kind of fun, bringing in a lot of characters, puppet, you know, creatures, characters from the animated show. And I'm just, you know, preparing myself, and I think I've come to an acceptance of like you, Jeff, give me a 70 out of 100 Star Wars movie on the big screen. I'll have a fun time.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that, like, it's kind of mixed feelings because you see all the stuff that you do love that Filoni and Favreau get more than seemingly anyone else in Star Wars, which is, you know, practical effects, puppets, great sets, design. You get some cool fights with the monsters, the Imperial goons and Baby Yoda, all that stuff. But at the same time, like, I do feel like the property has been, and again, Star Wars stuff is almost always, except for maybe Andor, exclusively or more geared towards kids. This does feel a little more like infantile to me when I watched it. When I'm watching, I'm like, this is directly for children. Like there is no doubt about it. I think when you watch some or read the interviews with Filoni and Favreau about this stuff, they're like, yeah, we want it to feel like you're playing with toys again. And like, you definitely get that sense when you watch this trailer. Like, that's what this is. It's not going to be, you know, some big, like, it's not definitely not Andor, but definitely not even something like the first season of Mandalorian, which I think the first season of Mandalorian, you see a guy get cut in half in the first 5 minutes of this series. You see, like, you know, the Imperial helmets on spikes. You have big battles. You have, like, pretty, like, I would say more, not adult themes, but, like, more grown up than child themes. And this feels like, hey, here's Baby Yoda doing one-liners. Like, okay.
That's, yeah.
And but, like you said, Gooch, I do think that this is good for them to get this out of the way and be like, this is what the movie is. Do not come in expecting it to be Mandalorian season one, whatever. This is no longer like, hey, here's this guy from this weird cool sect that's like kind of walking between, like, in the gray between good and bad. Like, now he's just a space cop and he has a little Baby Yoda sidekick, and that's fine. It's just, but my expectations are going to be different, which is I think both a good and a bad thing. I wish it was different, but now that I know what it is, I'm fully prepared.
Yeah,
he's absolutely going to speak, right? That little green freak is going to say something.
Yeah, that's my. I do think he's say something. I saw a screenshot of somebody's tweet. I apologize if I don't know who said it, but I did see the tweet where someone said Disney and Star Wars did learn the worst lesson from the first season of Mandalorian. Obviously, Baby Yoda. Now there is a level of, like, if you're them and you're Disney, like, whatever, you can say I'm bootlicking a corporation. What are they going to do? Not make Baby? Like, what were you going to do? Like, you had the pop culture eye character of the decade, still very relevant. So, like, I there is an extent, but yeah. So I do look, obviously, I hope that they have some of those moments, right? Some of those badass, like, cutting through people, crazy shit moments. But we'll see. As long as it's fun, that's all I want. And I will say the one thing I would love, like, a Filoni universe, like Clone Wars team-up type movie and all that. But it sounds like you're not going to get that here, which I think is the big thing. You might get some cameos, might get some teases. But it does sound like that would be a future thing if it were to happen, which makes me, like, pleased that this is just going to be, hopefully, a contained adventure movie. So yeah, Mandalorian Grogu comes out May 22nd, like very close to here. It's like kind of nuts. Trailer timing, just kind of wild. Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, which first off should just be called Peaky Blinders, the movie. Do we like The Immortal Man?
I think they might be trying to avoid the maybe not stigma, but like the idea of like Entourage, the movie, Deadwood, yeah, the movie. Like, I mean, they're just kind of trying to avoid that. Maybe, I don't know.
Peaky Blinders, the show, the movie.
Peaky Blinders, the show, the movie, yeah.
Amidst the chaos of World War II, Tommy Shelby is driven back from a self-imposed exile to face his most destructive reckoning yet. With the future of the family and the country at stake, Tommy must face his own demons and choose whether to confront his legacy or burn it to the ground. March 20th, 2026 on Netflix. Tom Harper is directing it. Tom Harper... involved with Peaky Blinders. You're not taking someone out of there who hasn't done Peaky Blinders. But in terms of movies, has not exactly done the greatest movies you've ever seen in your life. He directed The Heart of Stone with...
with Rachel Stone?
Which is a bad movie. And then like a really sneaky, like wet fart movie that I forgot about, The Aeronauts, the balloon movie.
Oh yeah, with Eddie the prime Redmayne, one.
Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones, which I forgot existed. I believe when we talked about that movie, back in the day, on when we were Lights, Camera, Barstool, I remember talking about that, and we went down the rabbit hole of like, does Eddie Redmayne only do like? Because the only good movies not set in the present day. Like it is, I remember that was like a big discussion. So I forgot about that movie. So that, but he's involved. He does Peaky Blinders. So it's like, this is still his thing. But to see that on his filmography, I was like, oh boy, that's not great.
There is a worse movie in a filmography of someone involved in this movie. I don't know if you, so this is written by Stephen Knight, who wrote Peaky Blinders, the showrunner on it. Oh, Stephen Knight, as you all know, wrote and directed Dad Boat. AKA Serenity with Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, that is true. Though that Dad Boat's almost a work of art, though.
It is so bad, it's good in ways. Man, that cat, can you really like put together how great that cast is? McConaughey, Hathaway, fucking Jason Clark, dude, like what's his
Simon
name?
Hansen.
Jeremy Strong is like a 5-second role in that. Yeah, and dude, oh, crazy. Insane stuff.
He's doing the Oasis concert film, which I'm excited about. Stephen Knight is.
And he's also writing Bond for Denny.
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
Yeah.
Good Lord. I never watched Peaky Blinders, but I will say this trailer did make it move. Barry Keoghan. I was kind of selling his stock for a second, but I think I'm back with him. Like, I think I'm really back. He looked great in this trailer. Like, perfect fit.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of funny. He wrote somewhere. He's like, yeah, I look more like Cillian Murphy than Cillian Murphy does. And it reminded me of, like, what's that meme where it's like when that hoe says that she looks like you, like, no, you don't, bitch. Like, it's kind of like that. I do think that, like, with Peaky Blinders, it tailed off a bit towards the last two seasons, especially the last season, which I didn't really care for. But this felt a lot more like season one, which has really good writing, awesome sound. Like, they're really good with music. I think Knight and...
I think that was a Fontaine's DC Irish band needle drop in that trailer, which worked really well.
Yeah, and Red Right Hand is, like, their main theme in the show is really good. The actors have been awesome. And they're adding in great actors. Like you said, Barry Keoghan is... They had him initially billed. I guess they wanted to hide that he's playing... Tommy Shelby's son. They had him billed as Pinto Shelby, which I thought was hilarious fake narrator or whatever name. And then Tim Roth, who's obviously amazing. Like Tim Roth, I feel like getting more chances to shine out was great. And then Rebecca Ferguson. I mean, you get Rebecca Ferguson into anything. That is a humongous plus. So I love Peaky Blinders. I do think that the bar for series ending movies is kind of weird. We're like, what's the best one? Deadwood? I like the Deadwood movie a lot. So I would say Deadwood probably there. Entourage is like pretty low.
Accidentally doing Molly at the pool party with Rob Gronkowski with Gronk. Stupid. Come on. That was so funny.
But yeah, I do think that you have a chance to sort of give a nice bookend, because I'm not sure how many people love the last season of it, but yeah, I'm pretty excited for this.
Next up, Pressure. This is the one I'm curious. Brendan Fraser playing Dwight D. Eisenhower. And the final day before the Allied invasion of Europe in 1944, Royal Air Force meteorologist James Stagg must deliver a weather report to the Allied High Command led by Dwight D. Eisenhower, which will determine the feasibility of the plan D-Day. Andrew Scott in the lead role, Kerry Condon, Damian Lewis, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Let's hear it. You're the history guy to the three of us. What do you think about this one?
I mean, a 2-hour movie about a weather report is, I mean, what do you got to get that made? I mean, whenever you can.
I mean,
it's weird because, like,
we're running out of World War II movies and stories to tell. That's just some are saying that.
There's so many good ones. Like, think about what do you call it? Was a Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare? Let's make like 10 more of those. I don't think we need to make the Weather Report D-Day movie about Eisenhower. But I mean, that cast is good. We like Fraser, obviously. I don't think he looks like insanely dissimilar to Ike, I guess. And Andrew Scott, obviously great.
No, there's a couple shots that looked better than I thought they would.
Yeah.
Which it's not imperative. Frank Langella plays an unbelievable Nixon in Frost Nixon, looks nothing like him.
Yeah.
It's not a necessity, but there are some times where it's like when you have the certain person cast, you're just like, oh. Yeah.
There are certain actors where I think it's tough. Like I think I talk about it a lot, but like Matt Damon, it's very tough for me to look at him and not be like, that's Matt Damon. I think there's very few movies where he kind of can break away from that. Like, for example, like Oppenheimer, like same thing, World War II movie. Like, I'm just looking at him like, that's Matt Damon, but I don't care because the movie's so good. But then there's other movies where I'm like, that's Matt Damon, and now I care that he looks too much just like Matt Damon, like Air, for example. But yeah, I do think that this is going to be a tough one to make care about, but you could also, even with the same thing, like Oppenheimer, you can kind of say the same thing. Like, D-Day is like the most important single battle or engagement of the entire war. One of the most important turning points in the world history is the same thing we can see with the bomb. So like it's you could kind of put that same thing, but you don't have Christopher Nolan attached. You have fucking Brendan Fraser playing Dwight D. Eisenhower. Like, I don't know. I don't have a lot of super high hopes for this.
Not at all. It reminded me of The Imitation Game. Remember that?
Yeah.
Where it's like, it is a war movie, but it's really centered around like this nerd on the outskirts kind of doing his own thing that's going to help the war efforts. That was a good movie. I guess that's the best case scenario for this, but I don't see it coming to fruition. And Brendan Fraser does like kind of, if you squint hard enough, does kind of fit here, but I don't really love the choices he's making post-Oscar. I'm glad he got that win. I do worry that he thinks he's more of a dramatic actor than he actually is right now.
He should be. Well, they got The Mummy. Remake coming
more
up.
Of a dour actor, I should say, like fit for really intense material where he's such a guy you want to root for. Put him in Rental Family, I didn't love, but he is so like soft and like you want to just give him a hug and let him do more of that. Don't have him do Dwight D. Eisenhower or doing weird yells and Killers of the Flower Moon. But you know, let us like him.
Gay icon like Dwight D. Eisenhower. Don't forget that one picture.
Wait, what?
I don't know if you ever seen it.
No.
You ever seen it? Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I'll be looking into this.
So this director, Anthony Maris, I'm trying to look at who the guy did this. The only thing he's done that I can recognize is Hotel Mumbai, the one that has the Army Hammer one, right? With the terror attacks. Yeah, weird crew here. Chris Messina. Hey, Chris Messina. He's on it. He's in anything. I'll be there. Damian Lewis, same thing. But yeah, not super high hopes here.
I'm gonna sneak this in here. Kind of a huge Oscar news just happened. Sean Penn won Best Supporting Actor at the BAFTAs, which is a huge race shakeup for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. The supporting roles have not moved much line-wise. Tiana Taylor's only minus 280. Skarsgård was minus 200. Sean Penn was plus 350 as I'm speaking right now on DraftKings. The BAFTAs is oftentimes an indicator for him to beat a European movie with sentimental value with Stellan Skarsgård. That's pretty big. Since the year 2000, the only people, I think it's since 2010, excuse me, the only people to win a Best Actor Oscar and not have won the BAFTA were Jeffrey Rush's The King's Speech, which that doesn't even count because like that's like if they make a movie about the king and the queen, I feel like that's an automatic BAFTA. So that's worth noting. 2013, the winner of the best actor for the Oscar wasn't even nominated. Mahershala Ali won the Oscar in 2016. Dev Patel won for Lion at the BAFTA. And then the only other one was Kiwi Kwan lost to Barry Keoghan for Banshees of Inisherin. So worth noting. Interesting little note there. So the race is on now for best supporting actor. Very interesting. Lastly, House of the Dragon season 3 trailer came out at one of the wildest times to release a trailer, when people are all about your other spinoff, which I started it. I love it. It's awesome.
So good.
All about your other spinoff. And then you drop this other one, which people are just not nearly as excited about, which is the significantly bigger swing of a show.
Mm-hmm. It's like, I love that one video of the backup quarterback. That's like watching the quarterback play great. He's like, he's not that good though. He's not that good. It's when you're spending, what was it? They get 1/4 the budget or something like that of Night of the Seven Kingdoms, and just don't have a lick of the same hype or the same charm or the same anything. It's just tough. Like, I still am obviously super interested, and there's a lot of cool stuff that's going to happen in the next season. Like Battle of the Gullet coming up, and a lot of interesting dynamic things. It's just, man, it does not have an ounce to me of like the same gravitas right now as Night of the Seven Kingdoms. Like, everybody is all on board Night of the Seven Kingdoms. Everybody loves it. Super charming. Everyone's rooting for it, because like, it's like the story that you want to get behind. Kind of like we were just talking about with Brendan Fraser, like the guy you always want to root for. That's Dunk. We all watch this and we're like, we're all rooting for Dunk. We love Dunk. We want to see more Dunk. And they're like, yeah, how about our Civil War happening? And check out Darren and Harrenhal for the 500th time. It's like, I don't give a shit right now, man. Give me 10 more seasons of Dunk and the Egg. I don't really care about House of the Dragon right now. So tough scene.
House of the Dragon is the Stannis Baratheon of Game of Thrones shows right now.
Dragging my fucking nuts on them, dude. Who cares? I want to see more Dunk and the Egg.
Really does really speak to like all these streamers and studios. They want to, you know, immediately get as much of their IP, squeeze their IP as much as possible. And it's really a lesson in like, you can't just throw money at it. Like, you really can't. Like, the source material has to be there. And by all accounts, like we talked about last week, House of the Dragon is like 2 pages in the book. And this is something that George R. R. Martin has always loved, this story, and is very attached to this project. And it makes such a big difference. We didn't really get to talk. We didn't at all get to talk about the last episode. Fucking unbelievable.
Yep.
Fucking unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean,
really,
that
really, really good.
That was insane. Those POV shots were just great. Oh. Like, everything. I mean, that's the best episode we've gotten of Thrones since, I don't know, season 4?
Season 6, maybe? Yeah.
It's been a while. I loved it.
Good, you know, Lord. What's crazy, too?
I love that little bald freak.
What makes it worse, too, is imagine being, Ryan Condon, the guy that is in charge of House of the Dragon, with, like, George R. R. Martin publicly denouncing you and going to your co-showrunner from season 1, who goes and makes this show and says, I love Ira Parker. Ira Parker gets it. We're working on this together. We like it. And I don't give a fuck about House of the Dragon. That's not my show anymore. I fucking hate this guy. Like, it's just, it's really tough for dragon heads right now.
Yeah. The timing, I almost thought, like, it is funny, because you look at the criticism that like Disney gets for like, even like Spider-Man, or that's Sony, excuse me. That's definitely Sony. Sony getting criticized, but Disney getting criticized for Mandalorian and Grogu and timing and Avengers. And like, they were maybe released during the Super Bowl and they waited and stuff. And then it's just like, there's like, drop this fucking Thrones trailer. It's like, maybe you were the one who should delay it. Maybe you should have waited a little bit. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, it is kind of crazy. It's a weird problem to have, because again, the thing that you're currently airing right now is so good.
Even come out till June. Just save the trailer for like a month when people like the fever, because Night of the Seven Kingdoms about to end. Let the, you know, the juices flow a little bit. Like, yeah, we want more Thrones. We want more Thrones. Don't do it when we're right in the penultimate episode. It's crazy.
Yep. And then some news, just in terms of some sad news, I guess we'll get to off the top. Robert Duvall passed away. Screen legend, icon at 95, and Eric Dane passed away at 53, had public battle with ALS. So two sad losses on different ends of the spectrum in terms of like what they were in, but both beloved and a lot of tribute. So that was quite sad. But I figured we had to shout them out, especially, I mean, Duvall adds now to a laundry list of just like icons, screen icons that are going to be honored at the Oscars.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I always fucking forget someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do. They do always forget. What if they forgot Robert Redford? But there's nothing better, by the way, than Sundance Film Festival. That those clips of like people at like an EDM show, and then it's like, this is what Robert Redford wanted. It's a big exactly. picture of Redford in the corner. They're playing like Levels by Avicii. Rest in peace, Avicii, as well. So yeah, just wanted to note that. Some other things. The war over. The war over Warner Brothers continues. Mudslinging back and forth. They're throwing James Cameron in the mix. Ted Sarandos went on the Netflix guy went on The Town with Matt Belloni and did an interview about the 45-day window. He was pretty firm on it. Which, look, if you're someone, and yes, I will note Barstool is on Netflix. I feel like we have to note that. Though we're allowed to talk about it and kind of say what we want, but I do think that's at least like. A positive thing to hear that he at least is sticking to the 45-day window thing and then releasing it on digital, no mention of physical. And then after that, Max, we kind of talked about in our group a little bit. Obviously, the whole thing is, honestly, I think both sides are worrisome. People kind of paint the Paramount thing as like a slam dunk. I'm not even sure that's a, like that kind of gets, I think, blown a little more out of proportion than it should. The best option would be if Warner Brothers just exists on its fucking own. Yeah. But that's obviously not going to happen. But My thing is like, I think the way now you have the president involved, I think the studios and all that, like, I just think there's no way it gets anywhere without like some ironclad 45-day window signed to. And I think you can tell whether you believe Ted Sarandos or not, or whether you know how much you trust him here. I think it's clear he knows there's been enough pressure where they do have to, like, they have to stick with that. Like, they have to.
I do think that there's. And like, I feel like it's weird because like we know what we know, but there's all these like behind the scenes things that we don't know. So like from my level, from what I understand, I feel like for Netflix, their best case scenario is the worst case scenario for theater goers. Like what Netflix shareholders want is subscribers, and what subscribers are safe, good money. Like theatrical releases are not safe. That's risky. So what they want is more subscribers. More subscribers happen when movies are on their platform and not when they're being released in theaters. So I do think whatever the case is for Sarandos, I think he will say and contractually agree to whatever the minimum is for windows and for whatever the minimum is for the amount of time. And then the second that's over, they will go back to everything's going on streaming. I think that's bad. And I think like the worst case scenario, and a lot of people say, like, you see it on Twitter, film Twitter a lot, they think like Paramount would turn Warner Brothers into some sort of like right-wing propaganda machine. I don't think that's the case. And I think if it was the case, mm-hmm. then artists just wouldn't go there and it'd go to other like studios that were releasing movies in theaters. So either like the worst case scenario, Paramount, movies are still going to theaters. The worst case scenario at Netflix, movies aren't going in theaters. So that's at least my take on it. I feel like I'm not learned enough to know though, for sure.
Yeah. I call it naivety. Maybe I am, maybe I'm gullible. Maybe I'll look like a dunce in a year. But it is one of those things too, where I do think there is enough beating of the drum for the traditional format. And yes, obviously you'd rather things stay in theaters for as long as possible. But like, I remember when Max, ironically, HBO, they did the same day releases during COVID and people were like, this is it. This is the end. And I said this when we talked about this last time and the time before, I said, I do think there's a little sensationalism with the doom and gloom with everything, because I do remember when, ironically, as I just say it, Dune came out, right? Yep. It came out in theaters and on digital all during COVID, obviously for reasons that did make sense. There was like a doom and gloom then. There was like, oh, this is it. Like, it's over now. Like, we're never getting shit in theaters. And obviously, it didn't happen, right? Like, they got struck down, the creators, the actors, the, like everything involved was like, this isn't happening. Again, maybe it's blind faith and it's stupid faith, but I do trust that there's enough of that. And I do think he was being genuine in that interview of like, yeah, this is what we are going to do. I just hope that that's not like a minimum thing and like a, this is what we're doing, or a maximum thing. This is like a minimum thing. And like, if things succeed and start to boom and blow up, then we'll continue to do it. So we'll see. It's crazy. It's still going on. And it seems like it's not anywhere near a solid solution.
That's what I was about to say. Like, the longer it goes on, the more I think this doesn't get done, at least in this administration. There's just so much shit going on. Like, are they going to focus on the fucking Warner Brothers deal right now? Like, yeah. I don't know. Like, this, there's so much, like, we can't untangle this, and we like live in this world, and people who are way smarter than us, like Matt Belloni, who like really have like inside information, have no fucking idea what's going on. Like, so I think this is going to go on for years, like, unfortunately.
Well, no,
it sucks because Warner Brothers is just absolutely cooking right now.
Like, it'll be, that's the thing, is it may be fortunate because then Warner Brothers continues to exist as it is, which right now is good. Like, they are making great movies and putting them in theaters.
They have all that debt. They have so much. They've just been fucking straddled with debt unfairly. Yeah.
Great work, fucking David Zaslav. Bonerhead. Loser. Idiot. Moron. Fucking, oh, we got to combine. People want HGTV on their Max app. Let's rename our thing 20 times. Idiot. Moron.
Hey, first off, good interview. I know it's a competitor ring or whatever, but Matt Bellany, good interview with Ted Sarandos. Hey, Ted Sarandos, we got Barstool stuff on Netflix. Feel free to come on here and discuss.
Yeah, we'll chop it up with you.
The only question he didn't ask physical media. We'll chop it up and talk physical media and push the boundaries with Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos. So come on here. We'll ask the hard-hitting questions. We'll ask if he's a Sklenard.
Oh, he's going to get Sklenard. He's full-blown Sklenarded. There's no question about it.
Interesting. It's a good interview, though. I would definitely watch it because it is interesting. And I'm actually curious now if Paramount put the name to the face more for their stuff, too, and tries to. That's definitely going to be the next step in this war right now is, like, doing that.
I wonder how out of bounds it is to us to get a Sarandos interview. Like, I would put it at a 1% right now, but not impossible.
I would never ask. But putting it out into the ether. Come on, let's talk about the theatrical release. Come on.
Hey,
but
Paramount
like ripped Alamo Drafthouse. He's like, you know what? Fuck
that. Yeah, Paramount's been over here a few times too. Maybe we can get Ellison and we can moderate a debate between Ellison and Sarandos, winner gets Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Have you guys, it's like, which one of you would hire Michael Titties to have a have an exclusive director?
Yeah, he should get the Fincher deal at a company. He should have the Fincher deal at Netflix, basically, Michael Titties, the Titties verse.
That'd be great if we gave them hypotheticals. We're like, okay, here's your hypothetical. A new Michael Titties comedy has made $250 million domestically, and it's day 43 of The Window. Do you keep The Window open? That's it right there. That'll decide the future.
Yeah, no, Michael Titties gets whatever window he desires.
What have we been watching? Anything people want to discuss? I mean, I'm gonna throw one out there at the start because it's all I can think about. And Ken Jack's watched it, I know, and that is the new Ryan Murphy JFK Jr. show, Love Story, which is getting a lot more publicity than his previous ones. I would say this is definitely second in line to People versus OJ. It's working. You're seeing, you know, you can tell it's working. You're seeing a lot of old JFK Jr. footage and photos online. I'm addicted to this show. I'm just going to say it right here. I don't think it's good. I also don't think it's bad though. Like, I actually don't think it's terrible because here's the compliment I'm going to give this. I think Ryan Murphy knew what he was doing with this one and succeeded. I think they know it's supposed to be trashy Kennedy smut. And I think that's how it's colorful. It's bright. It hits kind of like the Garbo stuff that you want to see, where in comparison, the Lewinsky Clinton thing was none of that. It was way too serious. It was dreary. It was dark. I've gotten some counters to that. And people say like, well, it's, you know, it's accused sexual harassment or blah, blah, blah. Yes, but also the OJ show was a double murder. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, let's not pretend the OJ show was like some soft material. And that one was, you know, that one had some ridiculous needle drops. But the thing that, and maybe Ryan Murphy doesn't deserve credit for this, but the thing that worked so well with the OJ show was you had some of the most iconic TV performances of the century mixed with some of the worst you've ever seen. And it was just unbelievable. And it's OJ and people love OJ stuff, but it worked. And that's kind of what worked for the JFK Jr. show. Because you have some good performances and you have some Naomi Watts as Jackie O is one of the worst biopic performances I've ever seen in my life. It's unbelievable how bad it is.
Good actress too. It's crazy.
But it's like, it kind of reminds me of David Schwimmer playing Robert Kardashian. Like, it's got this campy juice. Garbage to it.
Love
that
juice.
I'm like, I kind of love
juice.
This. But the lead, I think, kind of stinks. Like, I think he's not really
hey,
good.
Hey, that's Batman.
And yeah. Then everyone wants to play, he's all over, people want to play Paul Anthony Kelly. He looks exactly like him, by the way. He looks great. Great casting look-wise. He can't act. The lead, though, is Sarah Pidgeon, who plays, he's in a show called She was recently in the new I Know You Did Last Summer, terrible, a show called The Wilds. I think she's great as Carolyn Bessette. I think she's actually really good in that role. There's a shout out. Alessandra Nivola plays Calvin Klein. Yeah. Great corny performance in that. Like that works. It's a wild show. But I actually think it works. I think they did a much better job with this than they did with the fucking Clinton crap, which I thought was terrible.
I don't like it. I feel like Ryan Murphy, he used to be, and this was a Trobon's observation from a while ago. Ryan Murphy used to be a guy that could make one good season of television and then don't expect its dog shit out of him after that. And now I feel like he can't even make the one good season. Like he can't even get there because he's stretched so thin. He's doing that terrible Kim Kardashian show. Holy crap, that was so bad.
Yeah. People apparently like the Kutcher one, though. I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't watched it, but I've heard it was okay, for whatever that's worth. But these other ones you're making, they're just so bad, man. What was the Netflix one? The one with Ed Gein.
Yeah, Monster. Yeah. The Monster Stories or whatever, yeah.
Oh, my God, that was so bad. That was him, right? Am I crazy? I want to double check and make sure. That was...
Yeah, it's the monster shows. Yeah. He's the producer on that, right?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, he is. It was the first season not helmed by him, but he was on it, I guess, or worked on it, whatever. But that was awful, dog shit. But it was... I just don't like this series. As a Kennedy, I'm giving it my official stamp of disapproval. A big fan. I think that girl, the girl playing Caroline, whatever, it seems like they gave her the first take on everything. Like, all right, we're done. Moving on. Well, we're done. Moving on. Like these performances are not good. I don't think the story's done particularly well. It's very much slop TV. But I do think I'd agree with you to the point that like, that's what this probably should be. You should not be taking this hyper seriously. The Kennedy family drama is for the most part, like very sloppy, gross shit. So I think you can kind of play it.
Like I think like that, that's kind of my main takeaway. Look, like it's like trash and I enjoy it. But I do think on the most basic level, I think they at least had a better idea of what to do here than the Clinton thing. Because the Clinton thing was bad.
They have a Fassbender Kennedy series coming up soon.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. It's a spinoff of The Crown.
Yeah. Yeah. It's The Crown people do. Yeah. Yeah. That I'm going to be very interested in.
I'm sure. Very excited for that. It's the Kennedys, but it's The Crown. That's basically what it is.
Love that.
Wait, who's doing that?
Fassbender's playing Joe Kennedy, I believe, at JFK's dad. But I don't know. I think, like Jeff was saying, it's The Crown people, I think, in charge of it.
Because I was literally just thinking in my head, I was like, who could handle the Kennedy material and like make it interesting? And in my head, I was thinking Iannucci, like do a death of Stalin, but death of Kennedy.
Funny.
Like the moments after Kennedy gets shot. Like,
dude, there's so many funny moments you could do with that. Like, you could even make a funnier play on like Chap, because basically in Succession they do Chappaquiddick more or less. Like, you could do stuff like that for sure.
I've never watched. I don't think I've watched a single Ryan Murphy show ever.
The OJ show is a must watch.
Yeah. The OJ one, yeah, I always forget that was him. Actually, did I watch?
Did you watch?
No, I watched his. Yeah, I watched his. Yeah. There was those two that came out like right next to each other.
Yeah, the OJ show is like I will stand. I will take that to my grave. That is like incredible television. And it has amazing performances too. And it's helped by the fact that it's like everybody likes, like everyone gets it like into OJ shit. So that is like part of it.
Paulson's so good, and then you just cut to fucking Schwimmer. Come on, Juice. What are you doing, Juice? And Cuban Journal looking nothing like.
Yeah, it just works. So like it's that show just works so well, has some of the most he just got it there, and he didn't get it with the Clinton thing, and that's why I was like hey, this he's doomed on these, but this one I like, but this one is also trash smut. Let's not mix up what it is.
The scene where Cuban Jr. comes out and he's like shirtless and he's like maybe 150 pounds soaking wet, 5'7". It's so funny, dude. It's so good.
The show that other show I'm watching, which I think is dog shit, but I can't look away, is Patrick Dempsey in Memory of a Killer.
I keep seeing trailers.
Terrible show. By the way, I'm watching all these shows on Disney Plus because like now just Hulu's just on Disney Plus. So I didn't even know this is a mainline Fox show.
Yeah.
This is just on Fox. I must have missed like the promotion for it during football season or something, but it is. Angelo Doyle is a contract killer and family man struggling to keep his two lives separate. His worlds begin to collide when an attempt is made on his pregnant daughter's life. Angelo often visits his Alzheimer's-ridden brother in a memory care facility while there are signs that the disease is starting to affect him as well. It is one of the worst miscasts I've ever seen in anything ever. Like, Patrick Dempsey is beyond not right for the role. You got a bunch of Sopranos people in it. You got Imperioli's in it as a guy named Dutch. It is. There's another cameo, which I won't spoil. Another iconic Sopranos actor's in it. This show stinks. I can't stop watching it, though. It's so bad. It's just so stupid.
Didn't they do that with that Keaton movie? Was it Knox Goes Away? Like, it was like the serial killer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about Knox Goes Away.
The hitman that has Alzheimer's, right? Remember, right?
Who was in that movie?
Someone played his son, like a big actor played his son. I forget who. It might have been
From fucking Send Help.
Dylan O'Brien was his son.
Is it Dylan O'Brien?
I thought it was like
I might be making that up.
No, wait, no, it was James Marsden, I think. James Marsden. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I have not seen that yet. But not in the Seven Kingdom, glad you watched. It's man, dude.
American Assassin. That's the Dylan O'Brien, Michael Keaton movie. Okay, I mixed it up.
American Assassin, yeah, with Taylor Kitsch.
Yeah, anyway, Memory of a Killer, bad. There's also the Paramount. You know what's about Paramount? Paramount came out with this Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 movie with Ryan Phillippe. Go 1 Mile, stinks. And then next week, we're going to review Psycho Killer, which is sitting at a 0% of Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah,
what a horror week. Next week is Horror Week. Scream 7 and Psycho Killer. I can't wait.
Yep, I'm seeing those for sure.
And Clumber likes it.
Snow's really coming down here, Jeff. I don't know.
buddy, we'll get you a screening of Psycho Killer. You're a Scream head. You'll trek through the blizzard to go see Scream 7.
Yeah.
I will, I guess. Other
shows we're forgetting. The Seven Kings, like we said, awesome. Just so it's thrown so back. That POV shot, like you were saying, great. The scene where he gets up and like you get the get up, like, oh, that's like everywhere now.
Also, Ken Jack, I know you saw the comparisons too. Like, they are using anime tricks, like in the movie, or like structurally, like the narrative tricks of anime, where it's like you get knocked down, you get knocked all the way back to your like your origin story.
Yeah,
like, that is so like shonen anime, but it worked so well.
Exactly, but that's why it works. Like the stories of resilience. That's what we love as people. That's like the mythology of it. We love that shit. And then The Pit, still fantastic. I cannot emphasize enough. I hate medical shows like that are not funny. Like, I don't like serious medical shows. The Pit is so fucking good. It's fantastic. And then Neighbors, the Josh Shafty series, the new one. It's a trip. It's really, really, really weird, like bizarre stuff. Very similar to Renfair, if you saw that. We actually had an interview with the Renfair guy a while back. And very similar, I would say, to some of the other like Shafty, maybe what was the rehearsal, kind of like that in a way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Not Seth, that wasn't Safety produced, but that like Nathan Fielder ish adjacent stuff, but very interesting series for sure. And then Urchin, I watched the movie. It was very good. Harris Dickinson's first movie. It's on Hulu now. Very interesting debut because his first movie he wrote directed. He's in it as well, but also at Stephen Delane's son is the star. If Stephen Delane, you just talked about Stannis Baratheon, that's Stannis Baratheon's actor. But it is a very interesting movie. Very cool. I liked it a lot.
You check that out still. Haven't really been watching Nirvana, the band, the show, like the series. I will highly recommend that to pretty much anyone listening. I think you guys would get it. If you like the movie, you will love the show. I also watched, have you guys watched Common Side Effects, the animated series from HBO?
No.
Like Mike Judge produced. Watched that, just 8 episodes, 30 minute episodes. Very good. Like that. Actually straight up kind of loved that series. Finally got around to it.
I've seen the ads for that. I've never watched it, though. I do want to.
It's very cool. It's like trippy, but it has that kind of real world pessimism that Mike Judge brings to everything, where it's like kind of a take on the medical industry or the big pharma. And it's like, what if there was a drug that could cure everything? Like, they would fucking like try to kill everyone to make sure no one ever got that. And that's kind of what the show like explores. But it's funny and cool to look at. I had a great time with it.
Oh, that reminds me. I never finished Lazarus. I got to finish that.
Got some big Steelbook deliveries, two of which I have a better version of, but now we have it in 4K. One is Ben-Hur. Got Ben-Hur in 4K.
I thought you just got the good version of it, like pretty recently, right?
Yeah. I got the
Tony Kebbles
Elite, obviously. Got Nightcrawler in 4K, is now on 4K. That came out. Though I do giveaways on our Discord. Shout out the film crew. I'll be giving this away because I have the one from, I think, Japan, which is just the significantly better design. Like, what is this?
Pretty cool.
Like that looks, it's terrible. So this is the good one. But now it's in 4K, which obviously makes a big difference. And then finally in 4K, because I think the Blu-ray transfer stinks. One of my top 5 movies of all time, All the President's Men. on 4K, which again, I have a steelbook.
I feel like you have 10 copies of that.
Similar design, but a little better, but very excited this is in 4K because the Blu-ray, I think the Blu-ray transfer is like kind of stinky. So looks great in 4K, iconic movie. so that wraps up that part of the show. And now top 10. 10 next Hollywood superstar candidates. We'll call it that. We can maybe workshop the title if you need to. But 10 people that could be the next Hollywood superstar. I think our rule is, it's a loose rule. Like, I think if you make a compelling enough argument, we can bend the rule. But it's generally could not have been a lead in a movie that's made $500 million or more at the box office.
So we're looking for, like, top of the heap. Just to clarify to the listeners, like, top of the heap. Like you said at the beginning, a Cruise, a DiCaprio. Like, they have to get to that status.
Someone who, yeah. Big star. So, Ken Jack, you have first. Top 10 next Hollywood superstar candidates.
I do think that there's one actor who, there's a potential that he's about to get a big role. I wouldn't say it's a high potential, but it's definitely there. And I do think he's a really good actor. He's handsome. He's tall. He's got all the tools to be there. Let's go Jacob Elordi. I feel like he's going to be, he has all, everything working in his favor to be the next big megastar. And I feel like he hasn't hit the big property yet, like a big blockbuster property yet. Like Wuthering Heights, I guess, is the biggest, closest thing he's gotten to it so far. And he wasn't even really the lead. So like, if he gets the opportunity to be in a big blockbuster franchise, I feel like we will see a different side of him. And maybe he doesn't want to do that. That's very possible too. So, but I feel like if he wants it, he probably could take it.
Yep. I think that's a good pick. He's significantly more enjoyable in interviews than I think I expected. Like he's very down to earth, very fun. Like there's that famous clip of him with like his parents. Like the interviewer is like, who's that woman like in the reflection of the mirror in your bed? And he turns the camera to his parents, like sitting in the bed while he does the interview with TV. Like, yeah, I think I liked his press tour stuff with Wuthering Heights, like Frankenstein. I think he's definitely up there. He would have been my number one as well. Like I think there's a craving for him, and he's kind of got kind of the great come up of like where he's come from too, in terms of like the roles he had and like corny shit and streaming stuff. And so I would agree his star is kind of shining bright.
And if he gets Bond, it's like a totally different ballgame. Like,
right. I definitely like another level. Like,
yeah. I don't know if he's going to get that, but it would be crazy.
It sends him into the stratosphere though. Like immediately that would immediately send him like straight up to, I guess he'd be right there with, probably a tier below Chalamet at this point for like his age group, but he'd be kind of on his own right there in that second tier, I think.
I would agree.
No, he's fantastic. I really, like you said, Jeff, I love him in interviews. He's just very well spoken, and you could tell he cares about what he does. He very much cares about acting, and his project selection is, I think, fantastic. He's got a Ridley Scott movie coming up, and he's also doing a Cormac McCarthy adaptation with a Hungarian filmmaker. So like he's got cool taste, which I think is like a big part of becoming that top of the A-list. Like you have to have that Bond or that big franchise, but you got to be able to pick those like the smaller projects that get the critics and everyone else on your side.
He's talented too. Like he's a good actor. Like on top of all that, like sometimes you're just a face that like just it works in the right way. Like he's very talented.
Yeah.
Number two for me, he was in a big movie last year. He's now part of a huge campaign for like the second biggest global sport behind soccer, and that's Damson Idris. He's kind of smack dab middle of F1's next season kickoff. He was part of F1, big role alongside Brad Pitt. There's a small caveat on this pick as well. He is heavily rumored to be somebody who could potentially replace Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa as the Black Panther, which if that happens,
that would be awesome.
First of all, I think he's perfect for it. Obviously, we have no idea what's going to happen. It sounds like Avengers Doomsday is going to reset much or all of the universe, or at least Secret Wars will. So it does sound like you're going to get. And I also like as great as Chadwick Boseman was, it's too much of an iconic character to not give like a different something. I don't know what it is. I don't know what they do. But he's been rumored. And it's similar to Bond, less of an extent to Bond maybe, but also Black Panther's a big character. If he does get Black Panther, he's up there on a whole other fucking level. So I like him. I thought he was great in F1. That he's great in that role. He was also, again, reminder that the villain in that role was the internal conflict between the teammates. You didn't need the Tobias, speaking of the Crown, Tobias Menzies fucking flailing on in.
I'm here, remember me?
That movie, I love that movie, and I grew on me more and more, and I'm glad I got a best picture now, but that movie is like That's in like the 90s for me. If that fucking stupid character doesn't exist, that's the character is so stupid. Such a dumb character, so unnecessary. So yeah, Idris number two for me.
He's also, he's not like a betting favorite, but he gets thrown out quite a bit as a possible Bond. Like, is an interesting pick for Bond, and I don't hate it at all. Like, he definitely has that charm.
It's just weird that there've been two, obviously, like, black people who've been rumored to play Bond, and they're both named Idris in one way, shape, or form. That is very odd.
It's funny.
That's very strange. That is like, yeah, it's very odd that that's worked that way. But yeah, that is, I think that's kind of a key for some of these people, is like the first people we've picked now are rumored. Alordi a little heavier. Idris was asked about Black Panther, and he was like, that's not, obviously he could be lying, but he was like, I would love to. He's like, I love that world. The Alordi thing seems like that has pretty significant legs at this point. We'll see if it comes to fruition. The Broccolis are still waiting. Gooch, you have back-to-back picks.
For the first one, we'll stay with male performers, and this guy has been picking up steam. I would wonder if I asked my parents if they would know who he is, and that's Josh O'Connor. Somebody who's like not going to be that sexy leading man like Damson or Lordy, but he really, I think, has like a Hanks quality to him, a Jimmy Stewart quality to him that really got to shine through in The Last Knives Out, where I think he is just very easy to imagine as just someone you know and someone you can connect to, and there's just an emotionality to like all of his performances, which I love, and I think that's why Spielberg wants him, because I think that's a match made in heaven, that sentimental feeling that just kind of comes off of him on screen. But O'Connor, that's kind of the career that I like. Best case scenario, he has like a Hanks 90s, where he can just turn out not only movies that all of America love, but also respect and, you know, gravitate towards. And he's, once again, like Alordi, great taste, picks just great projects across the board, almost like
also another Bond rumor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although his is kind of like faded, but I still think it would be.
He addressed it. He's like, so much so he's had to address it. So yeah, that is kind of fun. Then three people who've been tied to James Bond.
I mean, but it is like for the Bond role, it's like they've said they want like a 30-year-old, 30-ish person. So it's like the pool is going to be like, who's the next superstar?
Like, yeah. That's a good pick. Crazy. Yeah, he was on my list as well. He was almost my number two. O'Connor is, I think, he's had a bit of stardom pop from movies that aren't like Marvel or DC or big tentpole projects like Challengers. And I know Knives Out's a property, but obviously it's not like a major property. So I think that's a pretty big sign that he's ascending.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now let's get a female performance on here. Stop between a few people. One, she won an Oscar recently. One is just absolutely gorgeous, and another I think just is very talented. I think I'll go with the Oscar winner though, and that is Mikey Madison, who that Anora performance just absolutely floored me, and I think she's been great. I mean, like, she was really good in a Scream movie, like a bad Scream movie. She kind of stands out in that movie. The thing that really interests me with her, one, she's gorgeous, but two, she, like, right after she won the Oscars, she just took a moment to chill. She took 6 months to wait, and probably she turned down a Star Wars movie. That's fucking insane for an actress who's 23 years old. Turned it down, and then I don't love that she picked The Social Reckoning as her next project, but it does make sense. It's like you turn a Star Wars movie down to go star in an Aaron Sorkin movie with Jeremy Strong, Jeremy Allen White, and a bunch of other talented performers. I think that's unique. And that's the kind of stuff that I think really lets people ascend into stardom, is just like, don't be in shitty things. Just don't do it. Like, no matter how big that paycheck is, it'll hurt you down the line. Mm-hmm. And I think she has that figured out. And she seems cool. Like, I don't know how to put it. Like, it seems like she could go a lot of different ways with her career. Like, I don't know how to pin her down.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very good pick. I think that movie, too, is going to get a lot of hype, whether it's good or not. Obviously, it has to live up to impossible expectations. But she's someone who is kind of talked very highly of by so many big-time people she's worked with, and obviously including Quentin Tarantino, and then plucked out of there because of like her ability to like just command the screen in even smaller roles. So yeah, I think that's a good pick. And again, we already won an Oscar, so that's right up there. Next one, tough between like a couple people for me, but I'm gonna go Monica Barbaro.
Nice.
Who seems to be kind of slotted in. I mean, it's crazy. Look at her filmography. It is a thin filmography. She's barely been in anything. With Justin Crime 101, obviously incredibly attractive. That definitely helps. let's not mince words here. Like, what goes into some of this? You know, we're not gonna pretend the first three guys we didn't name were hot as shit either. So
yeah, I mean, we addressed it. Yeah, like this, yeah, I mean, it's a part
huge
of it.
Factor.
Yeah, Top Gun Maverick, Complete Unknown had a very underrated performance in a movie that I didn't love, but I thought she was great. It's Joan Baez in that movie.
She did her own singing.
Yeah, her next movie is a movie alongside Callum Turner, big star himself. Then she's in Artificial alongside Andrew Garfield from Luca Guadagnino, which is an AI movie, I think, based on like OpenAI and all that, biopic. Mm-hmm. So she's going to only get slotted into more and more things. And obviously someone who's been in Top Gun, who's been in some big roles, big biopic, she's willing to take on the big roles. And that, I think, is a big factor in this. So I think you're only going to see her in bigger things, and she's only going to get cast more and more. And I just think she's someone that people are going to kind of gravitate to a little bit. So yeah, I'll have Monica Barbaro number five.
Yeah, that rom-com, I think, is going to be the one with Callum Turner. I think that'll be
One Night Only,
massive
called.
For her. Yeah. Great premise, and they shot it all on location, Lower East Side, Manhattan. It looks like it's going to be something great for her. And she's like the kind of star that can, like you said, pull off a Top Gun, pull off just showing up at Crime 1. That's probably not the best example, but a Complete Unknown, something where she has to do a biopic work. And then she can also, I think, do a rom-com. Yeah, which is just like, you can do that today. You can go far.
Remember how bad Eternity was? I don't know if you guys watched that.
Oh, Callum Turner. That movie. I've never seen a movie lose so much steam after 30 minutes, quite like Eternity. And like, it should have been so much better, but it lost.
Cool
all
idea. It's a cool idea.
I like that movie. I liked Miles Teller in it. I thought that was like the best Miles Teller.
Yeah, I don't even think anything were bad though. Like, I don't even like. I don't think it was. I just think it just kind of lost some juice.
Oh yeah, it definitely runs about 40 minutes too long.
Mm-hmm. That was a stinker. Cool idea,
Kendrick. You have back to back now.
I'll start with another actress, and I'll go with Kaylee Spaney. I think like her star is really ascending. Good it's pick. One of those weird things, like if you're drafting like a superstar, I don't know if that's necessarily like the world she'll go into. I think she could go on and win like, you know, 2-3 Oscars or something like that. But she might not headline like, you know, a tentpole blockbuster. That might not be in the cards for her ever. But I think she's super talented. And I think she's already, how much money did Romulus make? That probably made a decent chunk, especially versus budget, but that's a different conversation. But I think that made a decent amount of money. Like, she can do it. Like, she took over essentially the I would say like the spiritual successor role for one of the best female action characters of all time in Ripley, and she did a great job. And I think that's a very, very hard tall ask. And I think she's done great work in basically everything she's done, even if it was something I didn't particularly love, like Civil War. She's still always good. And I think it'll be a matter of like, is she gonna be a superstar, or is she gonna be like, you know, maybe someone who's a great actress that maybe your mom can't name. Like, you know, my mom probably doesn't know who Amy Adams is, but like, she's a great actress. So yeah. it might be more that's in the cards for her, but I'm not sure.
No, I like that pick. She was on my list.
Yeah, very good pick. She was on mine as well.
How old is she?
27. She's
so, oh, okay. She just has
not
a
as young as
face.
I thought she was. Plays younger characters. I feel like that's part of it.
Yeah.
All right. I got one more left. I'm stuck between two guys. Because this is my last pick, right? Because you guys have the last grouping.
You have one more. You got two more.
Oh, I have two more?
I think so. I think you got this one and then the 10th pick.
Oh, I do have the 10th pick. Okay, so then I will do... Fuck, I'm really stuck between a couple different guys here. I think David Johnson's going to have a great career. I think David Johnson's... We another Alien Romulus alum. David Johnson's a really damn good actor. And I feel like it might be kind of hard to break through. Because he's already 30-something, I think. But like he's a damn good actor, and I think that everything I've seen him in so far, whether that is again Romulus or it's Industry or it's Long Walk or it's like he's a really, really good actor. And I think if he gets to that next level, and he has the physicality too to be in like a superstar role, I think if he gets to that next level, I think he could be excellent. Like he could be in the space that like someone like Aaron Pierre is starting to coming into too, which is another guy who could be on these lists. And I think he's damn fine, and I would enjoy to see him in more big budget projects.
Yeah, the thing, he was towards the top of my list too, probably would have been my next pick. The thing that's really stuck out for me to, or about him to me, is that
like you listed, industry. He's like a very soft-spoken gay man. And then Romulus, he's playing a robot. Long Walk, he's playing like this southern man from Alabama. Big physical performance. Rai Lane, he's a kind of quirky rom-com role. Like, he does it all. He's a very, like, completely different characters and transforms entirely into them. Like, range. A very impressive performer.
Range, a lot of range.
That's a good pick. I'm between two, and they're both in the same franchise. They're both in Hunger Games. The one has come out, one has not come out yet. I'm going to go, because there's a little more to work with, and I do think people seem to like him. I think that matters a lot, and that's Tom Blythe.
Mm.
He was in The Hunger Games. He played President Snow in The Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. People were furious he didn't play the older version, even though the older version in the new one is – way older, like they have to age him up.
Oh no, also, I got Ralph Fiennes. Oh no,
he shut was up. In People We Met Meet on Vacation, which people seem to like quite a bit. I think he has an energy to him that I just like. Like, there's something about him that kind of radiates that. I think he's a good actor. I think if he hits the right role, people are gonna really like, almost like buying stock of like Elordi before Elordi started to take off the last couple years. That's kind of what it feels like with Blythe. The other person could leapfrog him because he was in, I don't know if I was going to pick him, but could be another option. I will mention at the end, but because I do think that the Hunger Games franchise can kind of push people up. But yeah, I'm going to go with Blythe. I think he's got something.
It feels like me and you are you're the only person I feel like I've talked to who was also just blown away by his performance in the Hunger Games movie. I thought he was so fucking good in that movie.
Great. That movie is way better than I think people give it credit for. I get why it didn't crush like the other ones, but I thought he was great in that movie.
I thought that movie was going to be bad, like actually bad, and I think it was pretty great all around. Like, yeah. He was awesome. What's her name? Rachel Zegler. Really, really good. Singing obviously great. Like, it was just good. No two ways about it.
Yep. Gooch, you have second to last.
This is tough. There's so many people I'm excited about. we'll get to them, and we'll get to do like some honorable mentions at the very end. And I might be leaving some other big people off that I think probably have a better chance, but I want Gabriel LaBelle on this list. I'm a Gabriel LaBelle stockholder, Sammy Fableman himself. I thought that performance was fucking unbelievable. And then he followed it up with a movie that I think he shot before Fableman's, but it came out later, and that was Shake Shack, which is just a really good comedic performance on top of that. Coming up, he has more interesting projects, like he's got a movie called Just Picture It, and then another one that I think is, I gotta look at this, Crashland. Yes, Crashland, which he'll be two amateur stuntmen try to make a real movie to prove their lives have meaning. So interesting things that he has coming up, and I just like him as a performer. Very winning face. Gabriel LaBelle. Sammy Fableman.
Went from playing like a literal child to playing fucking Lorne Michaels like within a year. Like, which is a crazy turnaround.
Let's pause for a second. Let's throw a wrench into it. BAFTA's supporting actress winner Wumi Saku wins for Sinners.
Crazy.
So now it's like, huge now upset. It's the supporting, because you're like, oh, Sean Penn wins, one battle is going to clean up, and then Sinners, that's crazy. That's a crazy one. So yeah, the supporting races have officially, I was worried. I said the other day, I'm like, man, these races are bad. They're bad races. The Oscars, these are all over. Not so fast. Do not count it out. That's pretty crazy. The supporting, very similar to the actor thing, with most oftentimes the winner of the Oscar is someone who won the BAFTA as well, though it doesn't work quite as much with actress, but yeah, that's pretty crazy. Ken Jack, last pick, and then we'll do some honorable mentions.
I'm stuck between a few guys and girls here. I think I'll go with a guy that I like that's coming onto the scene in a big way, getting a lot of shine lately, been in a recently great series and an A24 movie as well. I fucking love this guy. He's charismatic. He's big. He's got a cool delivery. I think Cosmo Jarvis. I'm a Cosmo Jarvis guy. I think Cosmo, the problem is he's older. He's 36. Like, it's not like he's like some spring chicken or whatever. Like, but like Cosmo Jarvis has that like extra quality to him that I think is very, I don't know, like it's magnetic. Like, it's hard to explain, but like when you watch him in a movie like Warfare, where he's like starring alongside like a lot of like bigger names like Will Poulter and stuff like that, and he's the standout. And you watch something like Shogun where it's all on his shoulders, really, like to like give you the audience insertion, and he's nailing it, and like he just got it. He's got that extra juice, man. Shout out Ridgewood, New Jersey. Fucking Jersey native. But yeah, I like Cosmo Jarvis a lot. Again, maybe he's too past whatever to get to that point, but I think he has that quality that could work. And I feel bad leaving off a lot of people on my list here. Should we just go straight into honorable mentions?
Yeah, my one honorable mention that I have two, Chase Infinity. I had him on my list.
That's on mine as well.
Chase Infinity hasn't done, she's done so little though. That's my only thing. It's like, you're talking about like, this is it. It's one battle, but she's so great in it.
Heard she was good in Zion. Presumed Innocent too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Odessa Zion, I had on my list as well. Kind of the same thing where it's like, there's just not enough of a body of work yet. But like when you're that good in a movie, that's that consequential or whatever, I guess you would call it.
And enough to be called people call it an industry plant. That's how much he's kind of popped up into things. That's how you know you're
Bobby
on the rise.
The voice Bobby of Bobby Hills.
Yeah. It's fucking crazy. Sophie Thatcher, I think you could probably put on there as well. And I'm surprised neither of you, because you guys both like this movie a lot more than me. Neither of you guys picked Dominic Sessa for this list.
It's on my list.
I do like Sessa though. Yeah, I think he's up there. And he's in a lot too. He's clearly cast with intent, like everywhere. The other one I had was Joseph Zada, who's playing Haymitch in the new Hunger Games.
Oh yeah.
He was in the most depressing show I've ever watched in my life called We Were Liars on Amazon. I won't spoil it. It's jaw-droppingly depressing. Like you're just like, what the fuck? Like it's like a Tim Robinson-esque like meme reaction. You watch that show, you're like, what? It's the wildest thing I've ever seen. You're just like, this cannot be real. But he's in it and he plays Haymitch. And if that movie hits really well and people love that movie, I could see that kind of shooting him up there. And we didn't put it on our list for most anticipated. I almost did. If I wasn't a Star Wars fan, I think I might have snuck it on late. But that Hunger Games movie, I have like weird confidence. Maybe because it looks so good in the trailers, but I do think that movie's big. Like he could kind of launch a little bit.
It's, yeah, it was the Songbird and Snakes being good has like restored my faith in that.
Yeah, franchise. People, that's I forgot you enjoyed that as well. That movie is like, I don't think it's amazing, but like it's definitely I know part of it was people don't love Rachel Segler. People love to rag on her. That was definitely part of it. But I enjoyed that movie. It's not perfect, but it definitely. Like that better than some of the other Hunger Games movies, at least the last two.
Yeah. I also had Sessa. Harris Dickinson. I mean, he'll be playing. That's one of those things. If that John Lennon movie hits, like that's huge. Eva Victor was like the one that I was like, that's out there. She's an actress. She's a filmmaker, writer, director. Like, is she going to be a superstar? I don't know, but she is just really cool and talented. Adria Arjona. That's one of those ones where she's huge right now, very charismatic. I don't know if she'll ever win an Oscar, but it's like if she gets like cast as like Wonder Woman or something like that, Jesus, she will be everywhere. Then last one, Austin Abrams from Weapons, and he'll be in the Resident Evil movie. Kreger like demanded he star in it. So that's got to mean something. And he was, I think, like kind of the standout, the one that – he was the one part of Weapons that I think everyone universally came away and was like, that guy, more of that guy.
Yeah, it's a great pick.
Yep. Really good pick,
but whatever.
That's a fun exercise.
So yeah, that's our list next. I think some big ones. Obviously the two that we didn't say, and obviously it's tougher, and I think they qualify. I think Powell, it's like you've already reached a certain height with Powell where it's like weird to put Glenn Powell on that list. I'd say Paul Mescal the same. But they don't qualify for that.
And he got the shot, I would say, in Gladiator 2, where you get the biggest budget, you get the big IP, you get the big like fucking release point, you get everything, and it bombs. Like that's tough.
Yeah, that's what I came. I thought about throwing him on the list, but I actually just don't know if he'll ever ascend to those heights. Like I think he's just going to be an indie guy. Like he'll be an Oscar player for now until he dies, but like. Will he be the big franchise guy, like global star?
Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing either. That's like
not at all.
Same thing with Elordi. Like Elordi might never try to be the big blockbuster guy. He might just be a guy that tries to make like good artistic movies, and that's not a bad thing either. That's not a bad thing by any means.
Yep. No. Yep. We have our own vote for our own awards, Ken Jack. If you want to,
We do. We have our own vote coming up, and you'll have the link to it in our description. Our own PBS Movie Awards. I polled the people in our office that I do know watch movies. Had them all pick out at different movies and actors for different categories alongside, I would say, most of the major award contenders. And so you'll have most of like the big above the line stuff, but then you'll also have some other ones like what's the most underrated performance movie, what was the worst movie you saw, stuff like that. I'm gonna poll that. You got use your guys' votes, use our votes, and then come out with our winner probably sometime around Oscar time. So if you look at the link in the description, you can vote there.
Yep, yep. Should be fun. Oscar season is right around the corner. Next week on the show we have Psycho Killer and Scream 7.
Man, that snow's really coming down.
I'll get you a print. Tarantino will deliver a print to your doorstep. A Psycho Killer. I'm excited to talk about both. Psycho Killer is an interesting one because anything that's a 0 out of 100, 0% around tomatoes, I think is always an interesting discussion of like, does it deserve it? Is this now a trend of making sure you don't rate? It's interesting. I've seen it. Clemmer saw it as well. But also, I'm very excited to talk about Scream 7 because what a fascinating franchise. Have they pushed that movie? Have they promoted Scream 7? I don't see it anywhere. There's a Scream movie coming out in 7 days, and you wouldn't even know. It's kind of nuts.
Not that interested in watching, to tell you the truth.
Also, like, releasing it on the end of February, it's just fucking crazy to me. That is it. Clemmer will be back next week. I also have Kirk coming back in a couple weeks as well. We'll be locked and loaded around Oscar time.
Hell yeah.
Especially around, like, Project Hail Mary coming out, which is a lot of hype. So, yeah, things are starting to pick up. Wasn't a bad January and February, though. So it could have been we've had way worse. That is it for Ken, Jack, and Gooch. I'm Jeff DeLitt. We'll talk to you next time.
Stella Blue Coffee's new can lattes are here. Crafted with 100% Colombian coffee, each can is a good source of protein and comes in two smooth flavors, espresso cafe mocha and espresso sweet cream. And whether you're braving your morning commute or chasing your pup, Stella Blue cans are for those always on the go and for those who care. Stella Blue is more than just great coffee. It's about giving back. I named the brand after my rescue dog, Stella, who inspired our mission to help more dogs find their forever homes. Every purchase supports animal rescue organizations. So when you drink Stella Blue, you're not just fueling your day, you're saving a dog's life. Try the new cans today. Taste the difference and make a difference. All new Stella Blue coffee can lattes now available at stellabluecoffee.com or subscribe on Amazon for 10% off. Stella Blue coffee ready to drink can lattes are officially available nationwide at Target. That's right. Whether you're making a Target run for toothpaste, paper towels, or somehow spending $200 on things you didn't know you needed, stop by the coffee section and see why everyone is turning to Stella Blue. The cans are made with 100% Colombian coffee, real dairy, real sugar, and contain 190 milligrams of caffeine. They've got dessert-level flavor with coffee-level function. You can choose from espresso, sweet cream, or espresso cafe mocha. And once you try them, you'll understand why they're the best canned lattes out there. Here's the best part. 100% of proceeds will go toward our We Brew to Rescue mission, in which we're funding the adoption of 1,000 pets across the country. Grab a Stella Blue at Target, taste the difference, and make a difference. Stella Blue Coffee.